Sounds of Radio 4's shipping forecast.
Fourth, tide, bogger, fisher, German bike, upper, south or southwest.
Handcrafted to soothe your soul. The sleeping forecast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday the 8th of September. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Sir Keir Starmer says his government won't shirk hard decisions just to stay popular. The TUC begins its first annual conference under a Labour government for more than 10 years, and the King is marking 2 years since he ascended to the throne. The Prime Minister has told the BBC that his new government is going to have to be unpopular if it wants to change the country. Speaking to Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, and in his first major interview in Number 10, Sir Keir Starmer said it was vital to do difficult things now, such as the cuts to pensioners' winter fuel payments, and not to run away from hard choices, which he accused previous governments of doing. He was speaking to Laura Koonsberg, who has this report.
Politicians normally try to grow their popularity, but barely 2 months into office, the Prime Minister says his government is going to have to lose favour with the public. Defending his decision to strip most pensioners of the winter fuel allowance, he told me he was resolved to take difficult decisions early in office to sort out the country's problems.
Popular decisions aren't tough, they're easy. When we talk about tough decisions, I'm talking about tough decisions, the things the last government ran away from, that governments traditionally run away from. I'm convinced that because they've run away from difficult decisions, we haven't got the change we need for the country.
Sir Keir will be tested in Parliament on that resolve this week, when MPs vote on the winter fuel decision.
And you can see the full interview on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg on BBC One at 9 o'clock this morning. The NHS Confederation, which speaks for the health service in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, says the government's plans to cut waiting lists for routine treatment are not realistic. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, wants to see 40,000 more operations and appointments each week, but Matthew Taylor, the NHS Confederation's chief executive, said that alone wouldn't cut waiting lists.
We support Wes Streeting's plan to reduce waiting lists, and we support the measures that he's committed to. But our analysis shows that the combination of the size of waiting lists, 7.5 million people, and the growth in demand means that what the Secretary of State has announced will only go a very small way to meeting his target. We're going to have to do a whole lot of other things as well.
The first TUC conference under a Labour government for more than a decade begins in Brighton later on today. Delegates are expected to press the case for more public sector pay rises and more workplace rights. The demands are a challenge for Labour, as Zoe Conway reports.
The government talks about the dire state of public finances, yet this week unions are expected to vote to campaign for above-inflation pay rises for years to come. Tomorrow, the General Secretary of Unite, Sharon Graham, will criticise the government for means-testing pensioners' winter fuel allowance. And the government's commitment to public service reform and its determination to be pro-business could well test Labour's relations with the unions.
Huge demonstrations have taken place in cities across Israel, calling for the government to bring home the remaining hostages held by Hamas. Organisers said that 500,000 people were on the streets in Tel Aviv, many of them outside Israel's defence ministry. Simultaneous protests took place in cities including Jerusalem and Haifa. Sport. Britain's men's tennis number one, Jack Draper, has been reflecting on his defeat in the US Open semi-finals. He blamed nerves after being sick on court 3 times during the match against the world number one, Jannik Sinner. Draper told the BBC the problem wasn't due to a lack of hard work in training, and he was determined to address it.
I push my body to the limit all the time. You know, I don't have to worry about sort of not doing enough, because I am, you know, which points to the fact that, you know, a lot of the issues I have are mental, and I'm gonna have to work on that and really understand myself better in order to, you know, compete at these highest levels.
Great Britain's Hannah Cockcroft has won the 9th Paralympic gold medal of her career in the T34 800 metres final in Paris. Paralympics GB are currently second in the medal table heading into the final day. And the King is marking 2 years since the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth, and his accession to the throne. A special edition of Songs of Praise on BBC One this afternoon will feature a new hymn commissioned by the King. Here's our reporter, Guy Lambert.
The King is expected to attend Crathy Kirk Church, the royal family's regular place of worship when staying at Balmoral, where he'll spend time in prayer and reflection. As the accession day falls on a Sunday, when gun salutes traditionally do not take place, they'll be held at Hyde Park and the Tower of London tomorrow. In the past year, the King was forced to spend around 3 months away from public-facing duties after being diagnosed with cancer. According to a royal source, his determination to be as public as possible about his illness has helped him through recent months, and his health is now heading in a very positive trajectory.
Guy Lambert, BBC News.
Laurie Taylor is thinking aloud in a moment, looking at the British elite over the last 100 years or so and focusing on the route through private schools and Oxbridge colleges. Then at 6:30, we're off to the Highlands to talk compost with a crofter, Marion Austin, in On Your Farm. First, a look ahead to Friday.
On BBC Radio 4.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
A new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The public demonstrations have all been organized by Iranians. I can say that with hand on heart.
Starring Ed Harris and me, Kim Cattrall.
Do you just want to hear what you want to hear? Or are you asking for a professional assessment from CIA's senior female analyst of estimative probabilities?
Central Intelligence on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Just got a cable from Washington.
I'm not listening.
We can't stay here.
Starts on Friday at 2:15.
Now here's Laurie Taylor with Thinking Aloud.
Hello. A very fine new book on the British elite reminds me of an incident from the time when I was a junior sociology lecturer at the University of York and was enjoying a drink with a group of students in a local pub. Now, as was common in those days, the conversation soon turned into a discussion of social class. And it was at this point that Barbara, one of the young women in the group, began to lament what she called the shocking persistence of class inequality. Well, this was too much for Paul, the only genuinely working-class member of the group. "Barbara, you've given yourself away," he exploded. "How do you mean, Paul?" "It's class inequality, not class inequality." Well, what stuck in my mind from this incident was Paul's recognition of the manner in which many of his more privileged fellow students, on this and other occasions, sought to play down their own class position, to maintain that they were no longer members of an elite group. And it's the very ubiquity of these occasions that lies at the core of a book entitled The Making and Remaking of the British Elite. It's co-authored by Sam Friedman and Aaron Reeves, and I'm now joined by Aaron Reeves, who's Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at the University of Oxford. Aaron, you studied the historical database of Who's Who, and you spoke to 144 leading professionals, including FTSE's 100 chiefs, politicians, newspaper editors, all that, to understand their backgrounds. Let me ask you, what led you in the direction of this research in the first place? I mean, what did you start off hoping to find out?
Underlying, really, the motivation for the book is a sense that there is a group of people who are able to exert incredible influence and power over British society. And we're interested in the kinds of decisions that those people are making. And there's also that a common narrative within society more broadly that some of those people in power are not making good decisions that are not necessarily lining up with the values of everyday people. I think this project was really rooted in that sense of the kind of inequalities that exist, but also trying to kind of cut through the caricatures that exist about the British elite. Who are they? Where did they come from? What are they actually doing? And we think that sociologists in particular, one way we could address some of the big challenges of our time is to look up and really try to interrogate those people at the top.
Now, the term born to rule, I think it's one which many contemporary British people would resist, find objectionable. We like to think we're a much more meritocratic society than the era of aristocrats with their country estates and their old boy networks. So tell me a little bit more about the future prospects of those born into families in the top 1% of wealth distribution.
So one of the things we did for this project was to take the database of Who's Who, this collection of noteworthy and influential people, which have been collected for many years now, and we tracked the families that these individuals have been born into. We found out the wealth of their parents when their parents had died. And if you look back in time to that era of aristocratic dominance at the end of the 19th century, about 20% of the people in Who's Who came from families in the top 1% of the wealth distribution. Now, fast forward to the elite that dominate British society today, and that's about the same proportion. About 20% of the current members of the British elite still come from that same top 1%. Now, this is pretty surprising, I think, because wealth inequality has come down significantly through the 20th century. And so to get underneath the hood of that, we sort of dug into the life stories of these families a little bit more. One of the things that wealth does is it alters how you encounter the world. It enables you to weather mistakes, to deal with risks, but it also enables your family to invest in the kinds of institutions like schools and universities that really oil your access into these positions. So in general, the people in the elite as a whole, you may not be surprised to find out that men are overrepresented, so too are people who are white. Many people live in London, they come from affluent backgrounds, they're often more likely to have gone from private education. And they also attended Oxford and Cambridge.
You found modern-day elites present themselves in a strikingly different way to those in past eras. You've got a couple of characters who serve as bookends for your narrative. There's Henry and Hugh. Now, both of them are corporate lawyers, separated by 50 years. So tell me a little about what these men illustrate, their similarities and their differences.
Hugh and Henry are both corporate lawyers. They're both men. They both come from wealthy families. They were born into advantage and privilege, and as a result of that attended boarding schools, similarly prestigious schools, and then they both went on to Oxford and Cambridge before having very successful careers. But what's striking about the differences between them is their self-presentation. So Henry represents the kind of contemporary yearning for ordinariness. He eschews his influence, he downplays his elite background and emphasizes really heavily the degree to which merit has structured his career trajectory. Hugh, by contrast, represents a kind of older mode of ease with his more privileged background. He's far more relaxed about the fact that his family involved had a full-time gardener and two maids and a nanny, and his career was certainly supported by family members, and is very blasé and casual in the way that he narrates that story. And so what these two characters do for us, kind of emblematic of a fundamental change in the way that elites present themselves, that's moved from a kind of stuffy aristocratic upper class mode to a much higher emphasis on meritocracy and sort of trying to convince people that I'm just like you.
And a related change, really, that you found in your study of the recreations listed in Who's Who was the decline of what one might call, well, highbrow pursuits. And I've got a reading here of the words of a former MP who you call Chris, and he's expressing himself rather strongly.
Five or six of my colleagues put drinking beer as an interest in Who's Who. That's just bollocks. That's no more an interest than pizza. It's just signalling. It's the number one accusation to throw at a politician. You don't know how the other half lives. You're all the same. So I understand why they did it. They're constantly told they're out of touch. Probably got private healthcare. Probably got this, that and the other. So they say, oh, well, I'm interested in beer, just like you. But people who drink beer wouldn't call beer an interest. On the other hand, did I need to put I was a Liverpool season ticket holder in my entry? It's the same spectrum. You think because I went to Oxford I'm a certain kind of guy, but actually, hey, I'm not.
That quote appears in a chapter titled Cultural Chameleons. Is there a significant shift that you discovered in the interests and tastes of those in power?
So if you go back to the beginning of the data source, which is the kind of end of the 19th century, you find what we call a kind of aristocratic mode of cultural consumption, hunting and shooting. But in the middle of the 20th century, what emerges is highbrow mode of elite cultural consumption. Now people start talking about things like modern art and classical music and going to the opera. And then what happens is people start to blend that with more everyday or ordinary kinds of activities, such as spending time with my family or walking the dog. But one of the things that this does not mean is that people start to eschew highbrow tastes entirely and that they're mixing them together. And the example of what Chris is doing alludes to something else, which is that often people will publicly perform ordinariness, while privately retaining a sense of highbrow and legitimate cultural tastes, the right kinds of attitudes and preferences.
And in one experiment, I did find this fascinating, you asked participants to advise a fictitious friend who'd been appointed CEO of a FTSE 250 company which elements of her background she should include in her profile. Tell me what they advised. How might it relate to your general findings?
We said, you know, you could tell this person, or you could advise them to talk about the fact that they grew up in a mining village with a grandfather who worked in the pits. Or you could tell them their father was a head teacher. Or you could say that you got a partial scholarship to a private school. But what we found is that actually there were striking differences in the proportion of people that would give that kind of advice. Around 86% of people said, you know, you should definitely mention the grandfather in the pits. But only 38% said you should mention the partial scholarship to a private school. And so what we think comes out of this is that the people that we interviewed for this, they would advise their friend to kind of emphasise parts of their background that would have the consequence of deflecting privilege, that would emphasise the degree to which their experience is connected with the kinds of experience of everyday people, and actually plays into this story that the reason that they're in these positions is because of merit and ability.
And you also analysed the beliefs, what people believe, the people in your study. I mean, to what extent did you find any, what we could call it, ideological coherence in terms of their political attitudes, their policy preferences, if you like?
Broadly speaking, we find a group of people who would align with the political right, with an ideology that's very similar to the Conservative Party, a group of people that would align with what we call the kind of more progressive left, and a group that sits somewhere in the middle, the kind of a centrist, more centrist group of individuals. And to give you a sense of the kinds of issues that they're divided on, these are issues around whether there should be more spending on public services, whether tax rates should go up on the rich, whether Britain remains a racist country. But what's really striking, I think, about this ideological divisions is the way that this lines up with different demographic backgrounds. So people from working class origins are much more likely to be aligned with a more political left ideology, even when they're in the elite. The same is true of women and also ethnic minorities among the elite. But that doesn't mean that there's ideological coherence, and actually these kind of more right-leaning positions are still very prevalent.
You do note that in the late 19th century, if you wanted to be a lieutenant colonel in the army, you could simply pay for the privilege. I think it was about half a million pounds in today's money. But, I mean, today, everybody can see there have been marked changes in the way in which the professions recruit people. You don't simply pay to get in. You can't simply walk into a career through financial bribery or because your dad works for the company or because you and the CEO went to the same school. That shift you must have seen and noticed in your research.
That's absolutely right. In fact, one of the characters we talk about in the book is someone called Sir Peter Daniel, who eventually became senior government broker for bonds and gilts. And at some point in his life, he was asked whether he thought it might be frowned upon that he got his first position in a company where his dad was a senior officer. And he thought that such meritocratic attitudes were kind of damned stupid, is the quote. He thought that kind of nepotism doesn't really do any harm at all. Those kinds of attitudes have long gone. I mean, I think it would be very uncommon to hear that kind of view expressed publicly. What I think comes through in a number of our interviews is that, again, in the kind of post-Second World War period, a number of big changes started to come out that really stopped that kind of process, a very egregious nepotism from operating. In fact, both Hugh and Henry, who we talked about earlier, mentioned both of these processes operating in both law firms and in the city. But I think one of the things that we'd note is that these processes have not been as successful as we might have hoped at disrupting the mechanisms and trajectories of elite reproduction. What has changed is that emphasis on kind of merit, on, you know, these kinds of processes. But in our view, sometimes they actually obfuscate the very real class inequalities that persist.
Akin to the notion of the old school tie as a route to advancement is an enduring cliche about the role played by membership of Britain's most prestigeful clubs. And there was a small revolution recently when the Garrick Club, as a result of a vote, admitted women for the first time. And I've got a clip here. This is from BBC Radio London on the 8th of May. The actor Juliet Stevenson describes her response to that decision.
The Garrick has for hundreds of years been a club largely dedicated to the theatre community and then, you know, the arts community. Any club that is dedicated to that community must, by definition, be open to all. Otherwise, what are you doing? You're going to make art or theatre or whatever that's just about the male narrative and, you know, I mean, it makes no sense.
Well, women can now form an orderly queue to join the Garrick. Amelia Gentleman, the journalist who broke the story, is with us here in the studio. Is job done for you?
One of the last bastions of male privilege in Britain has finally agreed to open its doors to women. So I think that is a moment that we should note as important. Obviously, we're talking about a very elite group of people, but the British establishment, by definition, is an elite.
Here is an example of a bastion of male privilege falling. Tell me what your data revealed about the membership of these clubs, and is there any sense in which the admission of women will impact club culture and perhaps even wider society?
One of the key things about private members' clubs is that they've played historically, and we'd argue continue to play an important role in British political life, both as incubators where common world views coalesce and take shape, but also as hubs that provide their members with a distinct institutional apparatus in some ways for converting mere acquaintances into tangible sources of social capital. So clubs that are part of what are commonly known called club land, around SW1 in particular, only around 10% of their members are women. But they're also very heavily dominated by people from Clarendon schools, elite public schools. Around half went to Oxford and Cambridge. And politically speaking, club members are more conservative than just other members of the elite in general. And because women in the elite tend to be more left-leaning, more on the progressive end of the political spectrum, admitting women may very likely shift the ideological centre of gravity within these communities. But that's partly dependent on the kinds of women that actually take up that opportunity. Many may not.
In recent months, there's been a lot of talk about private school education and Labour policies. You conducted your research when the Conservatives were still in power, and you looked at the family backgrounds of cabinet and shadow cabinet members at that time. What is the position now, and what might be the implications? I really was quite startled by these figures. They're quite dramatic, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I think so. What we see is that about 46% of Keir Starmer's incoming shadow cabinet were raised by parents with working class occupations. Around 7% of the outgoing Conservative cabinet were members of working class origins. Around 70% of Rishi Sunak's outgoing cabinet was privately educated at some point, whereas the figure for Starmer's government is around 17%. And that's actually significantly lower than former Labour governments, lower than Blair's, lower than Harold Wilson's, even lower than Clement Attlee's. And our work does suggest class background informs political ideology, that people from working class backgrounds who make it into these positions bring with them a sort of lingering influence of their class background on their ideology. But I think it might be too much to suggest that this new government is going to unleash a kind of class war necessarily. Elections change some members of the elite. There's actually a great deal of continuity, and elections don't just change that. And MPs are certainly cross-pressured. They may have their own preferences and ideologies, but they're embedded in institutions that also have histories and ideologies and practices that won't necessarily enable them just to, by fiat, do whatever they want.
Another key finding of your research is that many members of the British elite minimise their own advantages. They like to appear as ordinary as everybody else. On the face of this, might sound like a rejection of old-fashioned snobbery, but your study argues that it has negative consequences. What do you mean? In what ways?
I think this performance of ordinariness is really bound up with efforts to promulgate two very modern British myths. One is that Britain is a meritocracy, and the second is a kind of cultural egalitarianism, that one person's taste is as good as the next. And our data suggests that neither of those are totally true.
Aaron Reeves, thank you very much. Now, as usual, I'd hugely welcome other views on this topic. You'll find me at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. Many years ago, when I was a sixth former at a Catholic school in Liverpool, I remember being urged by one class teacher to apply for a university place. I opted for Birmingham University and a degree in English. Well, I was quickly invited to interview. Now, nobody at the school seemed able to give me any indication of what to expect from the event, so I sailed rather glibly into the book-lined study of my professorial interviewer. "You want to study English literature?" he asked. Oh, yes. Do you have any favourite authors? I really, really liked Charles Dickens and Jane Austen. Very good, very good. And do you have a preference? I prefer Charles Dickens. And why? Well, you see, he deals with real life, with what it's like to be poor and deprived. I see. So you'd say that Jane Austen was damned because she didn't deal with real life. I was not offered a place at Birmingham. How much better I might have done in my interview is made uncomfortably explicit in a new research paper entitled Private School Entry to Oxbridge: How Cultural Capital Counts in the Making of Elites. Well, its authors are Rachel Louise Stenhouse and Nicola Ingram, and I'm now joined by Rachel, who is a senior lecturer in the sociology of education at Manchester Metropolitan University. Rachel, you point out that around 30% of the intake to the elite universities of Oxford and Cambridge were private school students, despite the fact that just over 7% of British children attended such schools. Now, to what extent does this matter in terms of future life chances?
Now, the problem with this, as Alan's already spoken about, is that those people who attend private schools and who attend Oxford or Cambridge are overrepresented in elite professions. So there was a report in 2019 by the Sutton Trust which found, amongst other things, 44% of politicians had gone to private schools and 32% of those were graduates from Oxford or Cambridge. And perhaps more shockingly, 65% of senior judges had attended private schools and 71% were Oxbridge graduates. And we can see this is very disproportionate, this trajectory.
In the 1970s, Pierre Bourdieu, the eminent French sociologist, developed the idea of cultural capital as a way to explain how power in society is transferred and how social class is maintained. You're exploring how access to Oxbridge is facilitated by this cultural capital. Let me ask you to provide a brief definition.
So Bourdieu says that cultural capital exists in three forms. If we start with the objectified form, that's the form that we think about most easily. The books one reads, the films one watches, the highbrow culture one engages with. Then we've got the institutionalised form, and this is about membership of an institution, might be a particular private school, a particular elite university. And the key thing is the underlying assumptions of merit and prestige that attach themselves to individuals quite simply because of association with that institution. But what we're particularly interested in our paper, is the embodied form of cultural capital, the long-lasting dispositions of the mind and body, habits, characteristics, skills, how one responds in certain situations. And these things are very much deeply embedded in us. And it's probably the most difficult aspect of Bourdieu's forms of cultural capital because it's less concrete than the other two forms. And so it becomes the place where inequalities can function without notice or recognition.
Now, you quote from a 2023 prospectus from the University of Oxford, which states that decisions are not based on your manners, appearance or background, but on your ability to think independently and to engage with new ideas beyond the scope of your school or college syllabus. Well, that sounds like a very good intention, but in spite of that intention, you want to say it's still far from being a level playing field.
What we'd argue is that manners, appearance and background are not inseparable from the performance of thinking independently and engaging in new ideas. So we've got many people trying to access Oxford and Cambridge have straightforward forms of cultural capital, whether it's playing the piano, being a member of the debating society and so on. They have top grades at A level, so it becomes hard to differentiate between them on paper. So what we've got to think is, how does privilege work then? As there's still some sort of sorting method at Oxford and Cambridge, and this ends up being done at the interview level and the admissions level, even when people from state schools have the same grades as private school students, they're less likely to get a place. So we need to shift the emphasis from the outcome of private educational advantage to a focus on the mechanisms that are generating and cementing these advantages.
Now, the focus of your study is the Open Doors programme, which takes place in a private boys' 11 to 18 grammar school in the north of England, a school which has had great success getting students into high-tariff universities. Now, tell me a little bit more about the programme and its significance.
So the school offered an enrichment programme to its sixth form students, and part of this programme was sessions to prepare students for application to and study at elite universities. Now, teachers had autonomy over these sessions, so they drew on their social capital and their cultural capital to decide what to include. So there were 17 teachers who took part in this study. Seven out of these 17 teachers had gone to private schools themselves. Six had attended Oxford or Cambridge, with a further five going to another Russell Group university. Seven of these teachers had a postgraduate qualification, a master's or a doctorate, and 10 had had a previous career before entering the teaching profession. So these experiences meant the teachers were able to draw on these, as well as the social networks that they had been building, to inform their feel for the game of Oxbridge admissions. So they'd be drawing on what they thought were seminal texts or journal articles in the sessions with the students. In respect of skills, they'd be developing research skills, inquiry skills, adaptability, problem solving. But what's particularly of note is the teachers referred to putting students on the spot, making them think under pressure.
I've got the readings here of the words of a teacher you call Charlotte, and this is what she had to say.
I interviewed at Oxbridge, and at one of them, oh, it was horrible. They had three different objects and they asked which one was the odd one out, but they could have all been the odd one out. I'll never forget. It was a potato, an apple and an onion, and I got completely undone on the sodding onion because I didn't know anything about it at all, apart from it had layers, a bit like Shrek.
Well, Charlotte chose the magic sack exercise based on her own experience of an Oxbridge interview. Tell me why she chose it.
So Charlotte's drawing on her own experience and the knowledge of her colleagues to choose an activity which will embody cultural capital in her students. Now, Charlotte herself attended a state school. She was interviewed at Oxbridge, but she was unsuccessful, and she says that she had no preparation for Oxbridge interview. Now, notably, as well as using this activity, Charlotte says it doesn't matter what the answer is, but it's how you're getting there. And she says the students need to show confidence, communicate in this.
They're being asked to, well, to say something interesting.
Yes, and it's that display as well and how they're saying it. So this ease of performance then becomes magically transformed into evidence of knowledge and skills.
You describe the ways in which knowledge becomes worn on the body and becomes misrecognised as knowledge itself. What do you mean by that? Expand a bit more on that for me.
So prospective students have already demonstrated knowledge through past exam success and through predicted A-level grades. But the interview operates as this further sifting mechanism where interpretations are made about the student's ability to perform that knowledge. So a fluid and confident performance will naturally be read as demonstrating that knowledge. When interviewers are looking for markers of thinking and engaging in new ideas, they'll turn to manners and appearance as evidence of these.
There are various initiatives with state school children being invited by private schools to summer camps to help prepare pupils for interviews, and state schools being invited for visits because seeing the universities themselves encourages a wider range of applications. In the light of your study, is there any further work that you think might be needed to create a more level playing field? What might be done?
So we want to challenge assumptions by those involved in the admissions processes in which they're claiming that they're operating with objectivity. Elite universities need to interrogate their own practices on a micro level. There needs to be training in unconscious bias. The people involved in the interviews need to be aware of how they're interpreting cultural capital, because those from privileged backgrounds are recognised as being the right candidates with the right knowledge, as they have the right embodied performance of privilege.
Rachel, thank you so much. It's probably appropriate that I give the last words to a person we've been quoting in a way throughout, the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu. Here is how, in a nutshell, you might say, he defined his lifetime's scholarship. The point of my work is to show that culture and education aren't simply hobbies or minor influences. They are hugely important in the affirmation of differences between groups and social classes, and in the reproduction of those differences.
Thinking Aloud was presented by Laurie Taylor and produced by Jane Egerton. We're off to the Highlands in a moment. After a couple of things to look forward to in the coming days, we are just a few weeks away from the US election. On Wednesday morning, Gabriel Gatehouse has a new series of The Coming Storm. He'll be looking at a new divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. The Coming Storm is at 9:30 on Wednesday. Meanwhile, tomorrow on Radio 4, the astonishing power of numbers.
I'm Hannah Fry, and in my new series of Uncharted, I follow the data to extraordinary and surprising places, like deep into the ocean or far out into the dark vastness of space.
Stars are really, really big things. Big things don't do things quickly.
Each episode tells a story where the data unravels a mystery or exposes a hidden truth.
One of the really big questions with humpbacks is, why do they sing?
Join me, Hannah Fry, on 10 extraordinary adventures of data and discovery on BBC Sounds and Radio 4. Starts tomorrow afternoon at 1:45.
Now, this week's On Your Farm, and today Kathleen Carraher joins a composting class at a croft near Fort William in the Lochaber area of the Scottish Highlands.
I'm on Craigdhu Croft. It's right beside the Caledonian Canal, which follows the course of the Great Glen, connecting the west and east coasts of Scotland. Nearby is Neptune's Staircase, Thomas Telford's engineering masterpiece, with its complex of locks and gates. And we're in the shadow of Ben Nevis, the UK's highest mountain. I'm with Marion and Andy Austin, who own Craigdhu. Marion, you managed a ski centre near Ben Nevis.
That's right.
Just before you retired to agriculture, as you describe it.
Yes. Whether that's madness or not, that's what we decided to do. Escape from working for other people and start working for ourselves.
Andy, what were you escaping from?
I used to run a sawmill locally, so with a couple of hundred employees. But I'd been mill manager for a dozen years, and it was time for a change. So I've stepped back from the front line and then come back to the croft here to work the croft with Marion.
Being here in the shadow of Ben Nevis, does that affect the croft here, the climate?
It does, because the weather changes all the time and the bend attracts clouds. So Fort William's famous for being the wettest town in Britain. That means that because we're in front of the bend, we get some of that. Although then there's lots of days when it's raining or snowing on the bend and it's actually sunny here.
Yes, you have to be very careful when you put seedlings out, for example. They need to be strong enough and tall enough to survive a rainstorm or a blow of wind. And we also have to be very careful during the winter to cover the ground to make sure that the soil is not washed away.
The total croft is 53 acres, which everybody thinks sounds like a lot, but 35 acres is new woodland that was planted originally in 2011. And then we have several sections of mature oak woodland. And then around the house, there's polytunnel greenhouse garden. And then we have two good fields, one of which we use for growing vegetables.
And this is a greenhouse. Do you grow all of your plants and vegetables from seeds?
Yes, we do. And so we start most of them in here and then grow them up to a point where we think we can put them outside and they'll survive the weather and the slugs. So that's different to many people of our size who would further south who would be planting directly into the soil. The only thing we plant directly into the soil is roots, carrots and parsnips.
Okay. Putting those in next to where?
beside the tomatoes. Okay. And I think there's some French beans that need to find some space.
We are growing everything from salads and onions to peas, beans, runner beans, broad beans, fennel, and then roots, brassicas, radishes, mustard, and we need indoors, so we have a polytunnel for growing the Mediterranean vegetables like courgettes, squashes and tomatoes and asparagus.
It's 10 years since you and Andy made that career change. How has your business grown over the years?
It has grown organically, in that we just started off selling a bit of surplus, and then amazingly we found there was a demand, so we doubled what we were growing, and then we doubled it again, and then I think we doubled it again. There's more demand than we can cater for.
You're also a leading light in the Food Le Gabber network. That's a collective of local growers who sell their produce online. And you're also very skilled at compost making, and you run classes for your network colleagues and beginners. So there's a class on today, and you've got about half a dozen enthusiasts coming along.
Yes, we've got all these lovely people here to learn about composting and chat, and probably it'll go into growing and all sorts of other things.
It will aerate it as well, will it?
And that's the advantage of putting in this scrumpled up bits of cardboard and things, is don't put it in a flat layer.
Right.
Like, we're not doing lasagna.
Yeah.
We want things all mixed up, because the wee bugs and the microbes, they're the same as us. They need oxygen, food and water. So the mix is the food. Oxygen is unique.
Why do you run the compost classes?
Our soil can get exhausted if it isn't frequently mulched with extra nutrients, which is what the compost does.
So it's particularly important in an area like this?
I actually think it's important everywhere, but it, when you've got acidic soil and perhaps thin soils with lots of rain, then you really need extra mulching.
I've been making compost since I was as a kid. I'm 80-something now, so been at quite a few years.
We're also joined today by John Wombell. John, in 2003, you published a small booklet with the title The Spirit of the Soil. It's a lovely title. It was about soil fertility and farming practices in Le Gabber. Where did the title come from, first of all?
Well, the very first gardening book written by a Scot was written by a chap called John Reed, he'd been a head gardener on various big estates. And he wrote this book that was published in 1683. And one of the themes that recurs through his book, he speaks about the spirit of the earth and the spirit of the soil.
It conjures up a lovely image, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so. Yes, it's very appropriate.
Around the time that John Reed was writing, the late 17th century, what was farming like around this area?
Well, at that time, in the West Highlands, it was still very scattered settlements. It was before the days of crofts. Every niche that was cultivable, you would find a small settlement. But the majority of farming was subsistence farming. The records are quite clear that one in 3 years, it was a crop failure. People were always on the edge of starvation because of the climate, the high rainfall, the very poor soils, lack of knowledge.
There were a number of large estates here with walled gardens. What effect did they have on farming practices?
The answer is we don't know. We assume that the knowledge gained by gardeners for the lairds filtered out into the general population. There's no written evidence of that.
Some of them did import soil, didn't they? Because the soil here was so thin.
Yes, they used it as ballast on return journeys. When vessels had gone to foreign parts where they could get a load of soil, they brought it back and helped to build up the kitchen gardens of the great houses.
So when did farmers start to learn about the benefits of composting and enriching the soil?
Well, it began to be written about by the likes of John Reed. They knew the importance of soil fertility and regular manuring, you know, with organic manures.
You've got a great description at the beginning of your book of a recipe, if I might call it that, for composting. Do you want to just read me a little bit of it?
He writes, "For preparing my compost, I use a pit, wherein sometimes I make a hotbed, oblong, about 4 foot deep of length and breadth, as I can get dungs, vegetables and soils to fill it, here to lay all kinds or sorts with stratums of earth as horse, neat, sheep, pigeons and poultry dung, ferns, weeds, leaves, soot, ashes, sticks, sawdust, feathers, hair, horns, bones, urine, scouring of ponds, ditches, blood, pickle, brine, seawater, and cleansing of the house of office, etc."
It's quite a concoction, isn't it?
If you could gather it up and it was in any way organic, it went into the compost. It would have been a stinking mess. We don't make composting pits anymore. I don't think they quite realised the importance of aeration in those days.
If you don't have grass cuttings, one of the difficulties you have is getting enough bulk, mm-hmm. in that the bugs work better if there's a decent amount of bulk. So you want to be adding things to your compost heap if possible in a...
Was animal manure or dung, was that widely used?
Not really, because very few cattle were housed. There might have been 2 or 3 cows tied up in the barn end, if you like, of the house, and they were bedded, most likely with bracken rather than straw, and that was valuable. It built up, but I mean, you had only been talking about a few tons on any small holding, and that would have been turned over and used for potatoes. And to this day, if you're in the right place looking at the hillside, you can still see these little patches of green that are fertile to this day.
And all that you do is lift the black bin off. This often happens. We have slow worms when we get here.
They get nice and warm. The other thing they used was seaweed, wasn't it? And that was quite abundant in Loch Abber.
Yes, and still is today. And I think people have cottoned on to how valuable a substance it is. It makes a wonderful manure. It's high in nitrogen, high in potassium. There's not much phosphorus in it. So most people's preference is to use it to make compost by mixing it with cattle dung, bracken, and we got quite a few recipes from various retired crofters and gardeners which worked very well. Going out and cutting it with these little sickles, backbreaking work. They had to float it in rafts and then load it into carts or into creels and leg it up to the field, so it was hard work.
Marion and Andy, the composters are having a tea break, so while they're doing that, you're going to give me a tour of Craigdhu.
We're looking at one of our two good fields, and this one is a wild flower meadow at this time of year. It does get cut for silage for feeding our neighbours' cows later on in the summer, but it is absolutely full of wildflowers just now. The other field, we have a section of it that is fenced off like a sort of huge allotment, and that's where we grow the majority of our outside vegetables. So we have a 6-part rotation down there, starting with potatoes. It's slightly an accident where we're growing these, in that that's where Andy learned to plough. And having learned to plough, we planted potatoes. When you start farming at the age that we did, Andy had never even driven a tractor before we first came here. We're now both quite proficient at driving tractors and ploughing. The majority of our growing is actually what's called no-dig. No-dig is a relatively new concept. It isn't in Spirit of the Soil, and it wasn't done 100 years ago. at that point, people used to dig in the manure, compost, seaweed to improve their soil. Whereas now what we do is we lay it on the surface and leave the wee beasties and the worms to pull it down. And it maintains the structure of the soil, which seems to make it more fertile. It's not such hard work, but you still need a lot of mulch, which is one of the reasons why we need to make so much compost. The first plants from here were, we'd been sown in the greenhouse late February, March, and then brought on and planted out here in May. We're harvesting salad, and we will just be going to do our early potatoes. We can't plant out when the soil's cold, so you have to wait till well into April to sow your seed potatoes here.
So this would be much later than other parts of the country?
I think you would have got Ayrshire new potatoes about 6 weeks ago.
How would you describe the scale of what you're growing here, Andy?
If you look at the potatoes, for example, we'll get about a quarter of a ton of those this year, which we'll use roughly half and then sell the other half. And that tends to be the sort of scale, that's a sixth of our overall area. So you apply the same principles to the brassicas and the peas and beans. We'll eat about half and we'll sell about half.
We sell it as vegetables straight to neighbours and through Food Lough Aber and at a market. And then we use them to make things for value added. So some of this will be turned into salsa or pesto to sell on with a value added.
So tell me, Andy, you're getting some pigs, you tell me?
Yeah, we take a couple of weaners, that's the young pigs, and then grow them on. And this is a new area we've just fenced ready for them to clear. They're due to arrive in about 4 weeks' time. And they're Oxford Sandy and Black, so they're a rare breed, and really, really nice pigs. And this is about our eighth or ninth pair we've had now, but we're just putting them into a new enclosure where we need to clear some bracken, and pigs are great at turning over the bracken rhizomes. We will keep them here until they're about 6 to 7 months old, and then they go on their holidays.
Okay.
And they come back, and basically we will sell most of one pig as joints, chops, sausages, and then we'll put the rest of the meat into the freezer. So it's again another source of income for the croft, and it's a good way of improving the ground as well.
Marianne and Andy, thank you for the guided tour. Back now to the composting class.
Yep, we'd better go and catch up with what's happening there.
I've been talking to John Wombell about his book Spirit of the Soil. How often would you consult it? Would it still be relevant today?
Well, nearly everything's relevant because in the last 20 years, growing hasn't changed other than no dig.
Well, what about you, Becca? You're another local grower here.
Yes, I mean, I use seaweed an awful lot because we're near the coast and it's a fantastic fertiliser for the garden. So all the things in the book are completely relevant today.
Well, it's almost like it's been lost and then it's being rediscovered. And certainly in the commercial growing point of view, I think what is in the book would really help with the future biodiversity and sustainability. And so it's like we're having to learn it again, but it's all there in the book.
Marianne, you've taken me into the house now to show me a very interesting photograph on your computer. Can you describe it?
So this is a picture of the hotel at Neptune Staircase. It was taken 100 years ago. And it is the landscape is full of cultivated fields and vegetables. The hotel had a huge walled garden with lots and lots of vegetables and fruit in it. And it shows how much food was grown here actually not that long ago, 100 years ago. Lough Aber was capable of growing much of the food that it needed. Spirit of the Soil tells you about the amount of vegetables and oats that used to be cultivated here. So it is possible, despite all of our gloom and doom about it being difficult in the West Coast, it just shows how much used to be grown here, because they worked at looking after their soil as they did all over the West Coast.
round about 1982, there was a massive decline in arable in Lough Arbour, to the extent that by 2000, we'd gone from something like, oh, I think it was 100 acres of potatoes grown in 1982 to nothing by the year 2000. And agriculture in the Highlands, it changed completely with the development of supermarkets, pantechnicon lorries bombing up the motorways, bringing food direct from Covent Garden to Fort William. And everything changed in a matter of a decade.
You can probably see, oh yes, it's got odd things in it as well. You can probably see some kind of remnant of the sawdust, but basically that's actually probably usable as a mulch.
Susan Carstairs, you're a member, a very active member of the Lough Arbour Environmental Group, and you were the person instrumental in getting John's book republished a couple of years ago. Why were you so keen to do that?
The book was wonderful because it ties up modern concerns with waste and composting with some of the older culture of the area and the way in which people used the land and used the resources that they had available. And I think if we're going to make sense of the world these days, we need to bring those two elements together.
So does anybody else have any other questions?
I was quite interested about the weeds, because I haven't put weeds on my compost bin because I just thought weeds aren't good, you don't want them in there. So it was quite interesting to see you could have...
It just makes sense in logical terms to grow food in the place that you live in and not drive it up and down the country. I mean, people talk about food security now. If that lorry stopped coming, we'd all starve to death instantly because we grow so little. And I have always had an ambition of making Lough Arbour self-sufficient again in potatoes, onions and cabbages, which is entirely feasible to do.
So Marianne and Andy are doing a great job here at Craigdhow.
A wonderful example of somebody trying to work a croft seriously, and they've done a lot to try and encourage other people to retail the stuff that people grow. And, you know, there is huge scope for that to be expanded across the area. It'd be wonderful to see. It's a tiny drop in the ocean at the moment, but it is possible to do.
Marianne, given the decline in agriculture, do you ever feel you're fighting a bit of a rearguard action?
Well, I think there is also a bit of a zeitgeist now about people growing their own and local food. So it's not entirely a rearguard reaction. Some people are very cynical and go, why do you bother? But there is definitely an interest now, which wasn't there maybe 30 years ago.
On Your Farm was presented by Kathleen Carraher and produced by John Deering. It was a BBC Audio Bristol production for Radio 4. The news and Sunday papers are coming up in a moment after a look at the weather with Sarah Keith-Lucas. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Andrew. We've got a cooler and a cloudier sort of day ahead today. Still a little bit of warm sunshine across the west of Scotland, but for many of us, a fairly unsettled picture. We've had thunderstorms rattling north across parts of England and South Wales overnight. So we'll start with the detail across the southeast of England, the Midlands and eastern England. Well, we should see things brightening up over the next few hours. So most of the heavy showers and thunderstorms are easing away towards the north and the west now. We'll see scattered showers, though, developing on and off through the day. They'll be hit and miss, so not everyone is going to be seeing those showers. But where you do catch one, potentially heavy, thundery, there could be some localised surface water flooding. The heaviest, most intense rainfall is likely to be along the south coast, especially for the likes of Kent today. Top temperatures, though, 20 to 23 degrees, so pleasant enough in between those heavy showers. Through the southwest of England, into Wales and across all of northern England, we're going to be sitting under a weather front for a good part of the day. So a lot of cloud, outbreaks of rain, fairly patchy, so not continuous rain through the day. It'll be on and off, but the odd heavy burst, particularly this morning across Wales, where there could be some thunderstorms. Highs around 19 or 20 degrees here. For Scotland and Northern Ireland today, we've got a lot of low cloud, mist and murk around, so a grey start to the morning. That will tend to burn back towards the east coast, but we will see more lingering compared to recent days. But certainly the best of any sunshine will be across the west of Scotland. Northern Ireland slightly cloudier, but it should stay dry with the breeze picking up. And highs across Scotland and Northern Ireland between 18 to 22, not quite as warm as recent days. Some rain and drizzle in the east of Scotland later in the afternoon. Now, overnight tonight, we'll see showers and thunderstorms easing away towards the east, clearing skies. It'll be a cooler night than we've seen of late, with lows around 8 to 13 degrees. Tomorrow, low pressure slowly clearing away towards the east, so something of an east-west split into tomorrow. We've got cloud and drizzly showers, I think, for eastern areas. Sunshine towards the west tomorrow. Top temperatures are 14 to 18 degrees, but things turn increasingly unsettled, cooler, breezier and more autumnal feeling as we head through into next week.
Thanks, Sarah. Later this morning, Sunday Worship explores the ancient calling of religious life. Reverend Richard Carter from the Nazareth community will be here, along with preacher Dominican friar Father Timothy Radcliffe. That's at 8:10 here on BBC Radio 4.
You know what happens when you open a can of worms?
On BBC iPlayer.
You murdered someone?
They released me.
He's done well for himself. Nice house.
How does all this make you feel?
Like he's gotten away with it.
Some things are better laid to rest. Dead and buried.
All the things he has that my brother never had.
He served a sentence while I keep serving mine.
Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday the 8th of September. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Sir Keir Starmer has told the BBC his government can't avoid being unpopular as it tackles the country's problems. An official review of NHS England will highlight the thousands of children waiting up to a year for hospital treatment. And the King is marking 2 years since his accession to the throne. The Prime Minister has told the BBC that his new government is going to have to be unpopular if it wants to change the country. Speaking to Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, and in his first major interview in Number 10, Sir Keir Starmer said it was vital to do difficult things now, such as the cuts to pensioners' winter fuel payments, and not run away from hard choices, which he accused previous governments of doing. He was speaking to Laura Koonsberg.
Politicians normally try to grow their popularity, but barely 2 months into office, the Prime Minister says his government is going to have to lose favour with the public. Defending his decision to strip most pensioners of the winter fuel allowance, he told me he was resolved to take difficult decisions early in office to sort out the country's problems.
We will only deliver that change, I'm absolutely determined we will, if we do the difficult things now. I know they're unpopular, I know they're difficult, of course they're tough choices.
A note there, you said you know it's unpopular. Are you willing to be unpopular?
We're going to have to be unpopular. Popular decisions aren't tough, they're easy. When we talk about tough decisions, I'm talking about tough decisions. The things that last government ran away from, that governments traditionally run away from, I'm convinced that because they've run away from difficult decisions, we haven't got the change we need for the country.
Sir Keir will be tested in Parliament on that resolve this week, when MPs vote on the winter fuel decision. With his massive Commons majority, the vote is unlikely to make much of a dent in his authority, if at all.
And you can see the full interview on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg on BBC One at 9 o'clock this morning. The first details to emerge from a report on the state of the NHS in England, due later this week, have highlighted severe problems for children and young people getting access to care. The review, carried out by the surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi, also says the health service was particularly hard hit during the pandemic. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The medical expert Lord Darzi was asked to carry out a rapid review of the state of the health service in England. His report highlights waiting lists for children and young people, with 175,000 waiting between 6 and 12 months for hospital treatment. He also says that there was relatively a much bigger reduction in routine NHS operations during the pandemic than in other health systems. Sir Keir Starmer said he was determined to fix the foundations and rebuild the health service. But health leaders are warning that the government's plan to ensure that most NHS patients in England start treatment within 18 weeks isn't realistic. Ministers have promised to deliver 40,000 more operations and appointments each week. The NHS Confederation, which represents employers, says that will deliver only about 15% of the extra capacity needed to hit the target.
The first TUC conference under a Labour government for more than a decade begins in Brighton later. Delegates are expected to press the case for more public sector pay rises and more workplace rights, as Zoe Conway reports.
Trade unions have many reasons to feel buoyant. They've the most sympathetic government in 14 years. Public sector workers have just won above inflation pay rises. The biggest package of employment reforms in a generation is coming soon. But, as the next few days will start to reveal, there may be trouble ahead. The government talks about the dire state of public finances, yet this week unions are expected to vote to campaign for above-inflation pay rises for years to come. Tomorrow, the General Secretary of Unite, Sharon Graham, will criticise the government for means-testing pensioners' winter fuel allowance and the government's commitment to public service reform and its determination to be pro-business could well test Labour's relations with the unions.
The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, will travel to London tomorrow for talks with the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, on issues including the Middle East and Ukraine. It's thought he'll also meet Sir Keir Starmer before the Prime Minister travels to the US for his second one-on-one meeting with President Biden at the White House. A huge demonstration outside the Israeli Defence Ministry in Tel Aviv has called for the government to bring home the remaining hostages held by Hamas. Organisers said that 500,000 people were on the streets. Rallies have been held every night since the bodies of 6 Israeli hostages were recovered in Gaza 8 days ago. The King is marking 2 years since the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth, and his accession to the throne. A special edition of Songs of Praise on BBC One this afternoon will feature a new hymn commissioned by the King. Guy Lambert reports.
The King is expected to attend Crathy Kirk Church, the royal family's regular place of worship when staying at Balmoral, where he'll spend time in prayer and reflection. As the accession day falls on a Sunday, when gun salutes traditionally do not take place, they'll be held at Hyde Park and the Tower of London tomorrow. In the past year, the King was forced to spend around 3 months away from public-facing duties after being diagnosed with cancer. According to a royal source, his determination to be as public as possible about his illness has helped him through recent months, and his health is now heading in a very positive trajectory.
In tennis, Anya Sabalenka has won the Women's US Open, her second Grand Slam this year. The Belarusian beat America's Jessica Pegula in straight sets. And the British player Jack Draper has said that he will try to establish why he's been sick during some high-pressure matches. The 22-year-old reached his first Grand Slam semi-final at the US Open before being beaten in straight sets by the world number one, Jannik Sinner. He spoke to our sports news correspondent, Laura Scott, before leaving New York.
Jack Draper said his thrilling run to the final four of the US Open had given him a lot of confidence and taught him a lot about himself. But during what became a grueling contest against Jannik Sinner on Friday, he was sick 3 times on the court. The British number one told me his main focus will be addressing the issue.
This has happened a few times now in different situations for me. I'm going to really look into it. A lot of the issues I have are mental, and I'm going to have to work on that and really understand myself better in order to compete at these highest levels.
Draper also said that despite being aware of the recent narrative that he could be the next Andy Murray, he wanted to be his own person, adding he felt he was not yet the finished article.
Laura Scott. Well, that's the news. Now a look at the newspapers. And the Sunday Times reports that Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital is conducting an urgent review into the cases of 721 children treated by the same surgeon. It says some of Yasser Jabbar's patients were left with life-changing injuries such as amputations and deformities. The Times has seen a leaked report by the Royal College of Surgeons which criticises the department where Mr. Jabbar worked as dysfunctional. The consultant, who now works in Dubai, has declined to comment. Great Ormond Street has apologised and promised to address the findings of the review. The Observer says Lord Darzi's report on the state of the NHS in England will be particularly critical of reforms carried out by David Cameron's coalition government. It will apparently describe the reorganisation designed by the Conservative former Health Secretary Andrew Lansley as a calamity without international precedent. Lord Lansley tells the paper that Lord Darcy should focus on the here and now rather than trying to blame the Tories. The Sunday Express says Sir Keir Starmer faces a revolt by Labour MPs who are angry about his decision to cut winter fuel payments. The paper quotes the Labour MP Rosie Duffield, who told the Today programme the decision was brutal and shameful. The Express says Sir Keir is working to keep a lid on party infighting. The Mail on Sunday says tax rises being prepared by Labour are putting Britain on the path to destitution. Its report focuses on statistics put together by a firm which helps wealthy people to move overseas. The data suggests a record number of the UK's highest earners are planning to leave the country because they expect to be targeted in next month's budget. The Sunday Telegraph's main story suggests the BBC has breached its own editorial guidelines 1,500 times in its coverage of the Gaza war. It says a report, which used artificial intelligence to analyse BBC News output, revealed a pattern of bias against Israel. The research was led by a British lawyer based in Jerusalem, Trevor Asserson. In response, the BBC questions the use of AI in the study and insists that the corporation is achieving due impartiality. Under the headline Half the World Away, the Sunday Mirror reports that Oasis are planning to take next month's reunion tour overseas. It says the band are in talks about playing in the US, Mexico and in Argentina. The paper says international dates could take their profits to more than £500 million. And finally, the Telegraph's sports section says England's footballers hit the right notes in their 2-0 win against the Republic of Ireland last night. That's a nod to their new coach, Lee Carsley, not singing the national anthem before the kick-off. Yesterday's edition of the paper took a dim view of that decision, while the Mail wanted him sacked forthwith. This morning, though, it reports that the FA are standing by their man after what it calls a dream start. Our review of the Sunday papers.
This is Radio 4. It's 7:10. Time for Sunday with Edward Sturton.
Welcome to Sunday. The number of people attending cathedral services last year went up. Is it the result of showy experiments like mini-golf in the nave? And does that matter?
When I go to church, I go to worship God. I don't go to be entertained.
The gospel is good news. That's what it means. What could not be good news about people of all ages and diversities coming together in the Lord's house?
North Korea prepares to reopen to tourists, but if you go, don't always believe what you see.
It's very hard to tell whether people are actually observing the religion or if they are actors paid to play a role.
And there's a debate in the Church of Sweden about banning fathers from walking their daughters up the aisle. Is it old-fashioned patriarchy or a celebration of the ties that bind a family? Do let us know your views and experiences, Sunday at bbc.co.uk, at bbcr4sunday on social media. You will, I am sure, have seen and heard the coverage earlier in the week of the report of the inquiry into the Grenfell Tower fire. Official confirmation of the facts that many people already believed. The 72 deaths could have been avoided, and the causes of the tragedy included incompetence, but also outright dishonesty. We're joined by two faith leaders who played significant roles during the fire and its aftermath, Mike Long, whose Methodist church was just round the corner from the tower, and Abdulrahman Saeed of the Al-Manar Muslim Cultural Heritage Centre in West London. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Same question to you both, perhaps beginning with you, Mike Long, initially. What was your broad reaction to the conclusions of the report?
Good morning. I think a real mixture, to be frank, a mixture of relief that the truth is now clear, and that the things that people have been saying for so long and people calling for are now out in the open, but also that ongoing sense of frustration that it's taking so long for any justice proceedings to unfold. And I think that's a real difficulty for so many people in the local community and all those who've been affected by the fire.
Abdulrahman Saeed, what's your response to it?
I absolutely agree with my friend Mike Long. It's exactly the same feeling that I have, a mixture of two. And the most important for us now are really two issues. One, justice has to be upheld. And second, lessons learned and recommendations made are followed up rigorously. So another Grenfell does not happen, but also the recovery process for the for those affected by the trauma of the fire is really addressed amicably.
Well, let me follow up with you on that question of the impact of the trauma. It was such a sort of huge thing, and I suspect for many people involved will be the dominant event of their lives. Do you think it's affected people in your community in terms of their faith, either in terms of making them doubt or indeed of strengthening their faith?
I think it's it has strengthened the faith, I would say, because the faith community, as you mentioned in your introduction, were among the first to respond to the crisis. And also since then, the support to the community from the faith institutions that we have in the local area has never stopped. To this day, the faith communities have been supporting, but also acting as a platform and safe bridge for engagement between the local and national authorities and the community. And that has been recognized across the board. And I think that shows also the trust and faith people have in those institutions.
Mike Long, same question to you.
I would agree, but I think what would, one thing that may be helpful to recognize is that in the Notting Hill community, which I left a year ago, people have a huge resilience. And this is not the first experience for many of them of trauma. I remember one person saying to me, you know, Rev, this is not the first time I've been burned out of my house. And he had come from the former Yugoslavia, for instance. So within the history of people, there is a long legacy of coping with all kinds of adversity in their lives. So in one sense, the experience of profound suffering is not new. But I do think it means that the faith is very resilient and possibly a faith that is flexible, that is adaptable. And I agree with everything that Abdurrahman says as well. I think the kind of very academic philosophical questions about God existing or not are not ones that I've come across at all, I have to say, in all my years in the Notting Hill Methodist Church.
That's fascinating. It's just an assumption that people as journalists make. But to you, or to the people you serve, it means nothing, that question.
I think it hasn't. It's not a question that was on the hearts and minds of people in the local community, at least not that I ever heard. I have to say, I was never asked that question other than by journalists. And that may reflect that particular community, of course, more than elsewhere. And people watching it from, I ask those kind of questions possibly. And I think personally, you know, I see God in the vulnerability. I see God in people's actions. I see God in things like offering of love and support, and the call for justice, rather than a kind of crudely kind of interventionist, powerful God, I suppose.
The slight interruption on your line, Mike Long, but we'll persist. We had both of you on the programme, as I recall, on the first anniversary of the fire, and one of the things you both talked about was the impact of those events on relations between faiths, which you, I think, both agreed had been greatly improved. Abdurrahman Saeed, do you think that has endured, that sense of a new and more cordial relationship between faiths?
Absolutely. It has endured, and in fact, it has become even stronger than ever it was. And that was manifested in the partnerships in terms of delivering services across the board, but also even in the personal relationships. My friend Mike Long has just mentioned that he's moved a year ago to somewhere else in London from the Notting Hill area. Yet we are still in touch, and we still try to make time to meet up from time to time. And that's the kind of relationship that we have managed to develop, and in the service of our community, but also in sharing experiences and learning from each other.
Mike Long, your friends and stay friends, not just individually, but collectively.
Indeed, but also our community, absolutely. But it's also our communities. I mean, it's one of some of my greatest and most profound memories of the whole experience, sadly, amongst all the difficult things, was the hospitality and welcome that I was afforded at Al-Manar, for instance, on a number of occasions.
Mike Long and Abdurrahman Saeed, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. Now, should fathers walk their daughters up the aisle on their wedding day? That tradition, of course, has deep roots in this country, though it's probably less widely accepted than it once was. Things are very different in the Church of Sweden, which is considering banning the practice altogether. Sara Waldenfors, a Swedish priest, proposed the ban, and she told us why in a statement that's been voiced by one of our producers.
The relatively new trend that the father walks the bride down the aisle and passes her over to her husband is not in our church tradition. Even though the scene feels nice for future bridal couples, we can't disregard what it symbolises, a father handing over a virgin to her new guardian. Equality for women and other minorities in the Swedish church has not been easily won. How we as a church represent the liturgy of the wedding service is a question that the Swedish church has to own. The Swedish tradition is that the bride and groom walk together up in front of the face of God and get God's blessing over the union of love, equality and loyalty.
Well, Henrik Luva, who's also a priest in the Church of Sweden, opposes the ban. I asked him whether he was concerned about the perception, at least, that the tradition of a father giving away his daughter suggests the bride is a possession to be traded between two men.
I recognise there is absolutely some issues with the language of the custom. I would frankly prefer to find another way to speak about it in Swedish than giving away the bride, because that's not what's happening when it's used in our church.
What do you think is happening in that case when the bride and the father walk up the aisle together?
Normally, the bride wants to mark how important this person is in her life.
Do you find sometimes that brides want their mother to walk them up the aisle?
Yeah. The father is, of course, the most common. But it happens sometimes it's a mother, sometimes it's a brother or a sister. And I think we could modernize this custom. Why not let the mother walk the man to the altar?
Well, one of the concerns of people who are opposed to it is precisely that it's foreign to the Swedish church. Does that trouble you at all?
Well, I think the big question here is who decides the meaning of a new ritual? Are we to decide that its meaning comes from in the history, when it started? In our new context, in the Church of Sweden, in this day or age, it clearly means something else. So I would rather ask the question, what happens in reality, than how bad is the old theory?
There's obviously been a great deal of public debate about the question since the proposal came forward to ban this practice. Have you found in reality that there are more couples coming forward and asking for this new way of doing things?
Yes, I can see that there is more now than maybe 10 and 20 years ago, but they are still in a clear minority. Maybe 10-15% of the couples want to use it. And I mean, we also have same-sex marriages, and this custom can be a part of those also.
One of the reasons I think people are concerned about it is because, precisely as you allude to there, the church in Sweden has such a strong tradition of equality between the sexes as much as anything else. I think you had women priests right back in the 1950s, and therefore this seems perhaps a step in the wrong direction.
I can see the concern, but what I'm saying is that, okay, it perhaps has a bad history, but let's look at what's happening in reality. I mean, often the strong person, when it happens in the Swedish church, is the bride. And it's the bride who takes her often father by the arm and leads a shaky father up to the altar.
The vote is, I think, in the synod of the church next month in October. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think it'll go through the ban?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that the Social Democrats will get enough votes from the other church parties. And I think that the people who made this proposal, one of the things they really wanted was a debate. So maybe they can be happy with the outcome, even if it's a no to the ban.
Henrik Luv talking to me earlier. And if you have strong views on this question, if indeed you have debated it in relation to your own wedding or one in your family, do let us know, sunday@bbc.co.uk. Last Christmas, the Reverend Munter Isaac, a Protestant pastor based in Bethlehem, attracted international attention after a powerful Christmas sermon amid the Gaza war that followed Hamas's attack on Israel on October the 7th.
In our pain, anguish, and lament, we have searched for God and found him under the rubble in Gaza. If Jesus were to be born today, he would be born under the rubble in Gaza.
Well, shortly after that sermon, Munter Isaac visited Britain, and Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, refused to meet him because he was due to appear at a pro-Palestinian rally alongside the former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. The Archbishop later changed his mind. The two have since spoken online, and they will meet in person for the first time on Tuesday. At the time of the Archbishop's rebuff, Reverend Isaac said it showed, and this is a quote, the Church of England lacked the courage to say things. I asked him whether he believes that's still true.
We've seen more forceful statements from the Church of England, and not just the Archbishop, but other leaders within the Church. Even some have called the situation, described it as apartheid, which is, in my opinion, not even a controversial issue anymore. So we're beginning to see that the international community, but in my case, the faith community, is beginning to realize the seriousness of the matter, the urgency, and the fact that we cannot just to continue to use a diplomatic language. Given that what's happening in Palestine is still happening, my aim of this visit is to even to ask for more stronger language, because the urgency at the situation right now is so strong.
And do you think that can make a difference? I mean, surely at the moment this is above all a political issue, political debate, and the question of whether the Archbishop or any other Christian or religious leader can make a difference must be doubted.
I think at least we have to speak truth, regardless of whether we make a difference or not. And at the situation right now, if faith leaders are not the ones stepping up and saying, this is not acceptable, this must stop. If faith leaders are not the ones who challenge politicians, then who will? So I feel obligated as a faith leader to at least to begin with my own community, the church, to step in and speak truth to power. And I think faith leaders also have the capacity to change public opinion, which ultimately matters. And when I say faith leaders, please understand me, I'm not just singling out the church. Yes, it's true. Most of my work is with churches, given that I am a pastor, but I also work with Jewish leaders, with Muslim leaders. And I hope that this is an interfaith collaboration, because what's happening right now in Palestine is not I don't believe it's a religious conflict. But as people of faith, we have an ethical, moral responsibility to speak up.
And since you mentioned the political dimension of it, what is your judgment on what the British government has done in the past week in terms of suspending licenses for some components of weapons, which, according to the government's lawyers, apparently there's a risk might be used in a way that breaks international law?
I think it's a very positive step in the right direction, yet my fear is that it's still too little. This war would not continue, first, if Israel does not receive the support, the financial support, the military support, the weapons, but also the political cover. For example, you know, as we speak, Israel's continuing to expand its settlements in the West Bank. We all know this is against international law. I don't think there is any government that disputes that. Yet Israel continues to do it because they know they can. Israel does not feel obligated to comply with the international law. This is our problem. And so I see that decision by the UK government as in a very positive sense.
I'm bound to put to you what critics of it on the other side of the argument have said, which is that it's a message that Hamas should win, and that it was incredibly insensitive to announce that decision on the day Israel was burying some of the hostages who had been executed by Hamas.
Well, I lament the hostages who were killed. They should not have been killed. I don't want anybody to be killed. It's really unfortunate. At the same time, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Palestinians were killed. Even at the same day, hundreds of Palestinians were killed. And so this double standards in which one life seemed more worth than the other is part of the problem, honestly. If we don't see Palestinian lives as equal to those of Israelis or to anybody, then I think we have a problem. And at the end of the day, we need to come to a point in which we realize more weapons and more wars won't solve things.
A lot has changed since your sermon at Christmas. If you were giving a similar sermon today, what would you say?
You know, when I said that sermon and reflected the frustration and anger we felt as Palestinians and definitely the Palestinian Christian community, yes, millions heard it and millions were touched by it, but the war is still happening. So I feel as if we accomplished nothing. I will repeat it even with more forcefulness and urgency, given that not just the war hasn't stopped, but we're at the brink of this war extending to the West Bank. And again, nothing could horrify me more if this war expands to the West Bank. I mean, just yesterday, a 13-year-old Palestinian girl was killed in her house. When is enough is enough? And when will Palestinians be able just to live in peace in their homes?
They, of course, would say that the actions in the West Bank at the moment, for example, are necessary for Israel's security.
I can't believe that people continue to use the self-defense argument, especially in the West Bank, when it's Israel that is expanding. I mean, who is the aggressor here? Many in the international community still continue to buy and continue to promote this idea that Israel's actions in the West Bank are mainly self-defense. Who is annexing land in the West Bank? Who is building? Who is forcing towns and villages to be emptied of its people so that they build more settlements? I hope people realize what's really happening in the West Bank could really now become a much, much more serious situation.
Munta Isaac. North Korea has announced that it's reopening for tourists in December, reopening at least a small area in the north of the country. Those who visited in the past say they were shown lots of churches and Buddhist temples. But Jean Lee, former AP bureau chief on the Korean Peninsula, who's made many trips to the north, told us visitors should be wary and seeing should not always mean believing.
North Korea has a socialist constitution that does formally guarantee the right to religious freedom. But I would say that comes with a huge clause, and it is only state-sanctioned institutions where North Koreans are allowed to exercise any show of religion. And yet they want to show to the world that they do have religious institutions. It is part of their history and their culture. So there are several churches. Buddhist temples are certainly on the tour that foreigners are taken on. But when you go to visit these, it's very hard to tell whether these are authentic services and whether people are actually observing the religion, or if they are actors or paid to play a role.
Literally, and so I would say actors, as fake as that.
I would say that it is their role, the North Koreans were there to play the role of somebody who is either a Buddhist or a Christian. And it's very hard when you're in North Korea. And I spent many years in North Korea. It can often be very perplexing for people who visit to try to identify and decipher what's real and what's not. And so it's very hard for us to tell, those of us who know North Korea. We know that these people are hired to play that role. But are there also times when we're not there when you can actively, say, worship? Now, what I would say is that if there are Christians, for example, in North Korea, they would know that any kind of worship in private or underground would be extremely dangerous.
Christianity is a powerful force in South Korea. Do the same things apply at all? Well, clearly not from what you're saying, apply at all in North Korea, or has Christianity been historically more or less obliterated?
That's a great observation. South Korea does have a significant number of Christians. And this goes back to the history, the heritage of American missionaries who did go to Korea when it was one country. And they created a vibrant community in Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. And I think the first leader of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, his family was Christian. In many ways, the Kim family, the ruling family of North Korea, they drew and they do continue to draw on that heritage in the making of the cult of personality around the Kim family.
That's fascinating. Can you explain how they do that?
The first leader, Kim Il-sung of North Korea, did draw on what the Koreans were accustomed to. They were accustomed to Christianity. They were accustomed to a monarchy because Korea had been ruled for many years by a royal family. What he created was a cult of personality that is more like a monarchy. But to justify their position,
he drew on Christianity. So much of that language, he says that they are heaven sent. The mythology in there, the story about the Kims, is very much like the mythology you see in the Bible. And I mentioned that the Socialist Constitution does say that they allow freedom of religion, but the most important guidance comes from something called the Ten Principles. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, that is just like the Ten Commandments. But every North Korean knows that the most important deity in North Korea is Kim Il-sung.
If I was a tourist tempted by the possibility of going and visiting North Korea, what should I watch out for?
They say that they're only going to start opening up in this very far northern part of North Korea called Mount Baekdu. And so the main town in that area is called Samjian. And I have written about this town calling it the Bethlehem of North Korea because it is considered to be the birthplace of the second leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Now, that is a myth. He was born in Siberia, as far as we know. But that is the mythology story. So I always caution tourists to be very careful when they're in North Korea to recognize that they're being brought on a very specific type of pilgrimage. I would say that it's a very cold place where it's winter 9 months out of the year. So if you're going to go, bundle up, do not bring any Bibles and be very, very careful.
Travelers' tips for North Korea. You're listening to Sunday. The time is 26 minutes to 8. Still to come in the programme.
Ibrahim and I don't agree on everything. In fact, we disagree on a lot, but we're friends. And I think you can still be friends whilst you disagree with one another.
From mosque to synagogue to church, a multi-faith walk in the shadow of the Gaza conflict.
It's about you.
Me?
Yes. It's the story of your race. How your ancestors were born, how they grew up, how a vast war arose. It's the poetical history of mankind. If you listen carefully, at the end, you'll be someone else.
That is from the film version of the Mahabharata, the ancient Indian epic which is so important in Hinduism. The film was originally made by the late director Peter Brook, and it's been revived by his son Simon, who brought it to the Venice Film Festival in the past week. The journey to that premiere was itself something of an epic. Simon Brook told me why the subject is so captivating.
It's the most extraordinary, complex, dense tale that has, in a way, everything about the universe, relationships, morality, ethics, religion, history, war, peace, love. It's got everything in it. And it doesn't have it in it as a sort of reference book. But on the contrary, by reading this and thinking about it, it actually takes one into the path of exploring the complexity of the universe, and that one can return to it time and time again.
I've seen it referred to as an ancient Game of Thrones, but that, by the sound of it, is a rather trite description.
It is and it isn't. It's because it is primarily exceedingly entertaining. This was written as a form of entertainment in which there were, you know, moral choices, betrayals, all of these things, which I think the equivalent today probably would be, you know, some great epic TV series.
It is incredibly long. I think I've seen the figure of 1.8 million words quoted. Does that sound about right?
I've seen 800 volumes of 600 pages.
Right, so we're agreed. Huge, and therefore an enormous challenge to bring to any form of theatre or film. And I think your father first got it down to a stage performance of 9 hours.
Yes, that's correct. He spent several years, and I was fortunate enough to travel with him to India during my school holidays a couple of times during those preliminary research trips. And it was really a question of, you know, how does one reduce what is the equivalent in literature of a pointillist painting, where every dot in itself, every little story by itself is perhaps just anecdotal, is perhaps not terribly interesting. But once you have the accumulation of these, you know, tens of thousands of stories and their of these dots and their relationships between them, you end up with this very rich fabric. And so the editing as such is exceedingly complex, because you can't just take out chunks. I mean, you can, but you still have this thing of having to make sure that what is left, that final image, if you wish, is representative of the longer version.
The version you've been working with is a 3-hour film, so shorter, but still, you know, for an audience, quite a big ask. Knowing the text as you do, do you think really important stuff or themes gets missed out in the 3-hour version?
No, I don't. What's interesting is that as far as pure storytelling, yes, there are things that one misses because there are some wonderful scenes of the longer version and so on. But as far as the actual fundamental content, themes within it, everything is great.
Do you think, given that it is a very ancient text, do you think it has a direct relevance for viewers today?
I think it is incredibly relevant. It's all about the end of a cycle of the world as we know it. It discusses and explores the question of climate change, of overpopulation, of brothers killing brothers, of cousins murdering cousins. And it's, you know, you change a few of the words in there, and it is the sad news and the bad news from today's front pages. Now, where it's not a doom and gloom is that it shows that, you know, the world is an incredibly rich and complex place, and you have to approach it accepting this.
This film is very important in Hinduism. Do you have any, if you like, faith connection with it, or is it the epic nature of it that appeals to you?
Don't know what your definition of faith is, nor what other people's is necessarily. Hinduism, as far as I understand, is a religion that considers that it can encompass all of the others. And I think what is very interesting in the Mahabharata is that what it really refers to is this concept of dharma, which is the moral way one should live one's life. And I think, I don't know if that's a faith or a religion, but it's a lot of common sense. And it speaks to me. It certainly speaks to me.
Simon Brooke. This last week in London, there was a walk that began at a mosque, went by way of a synagogue, and wound up at a Christian church. Its purpose was to raise money for St. John's Eye Hospital in Jerusalem, but it was also an attempt to overcome some of the divisions which have opened up since October the 7th last year. Those leading the walk wore blindfolds to draw attention to the hospital's work, and our reporter Adrian Bradley joined them.
Welcome here to the East London Mosque and London Muslim Centre. We've stood right here on Philgate Street behind the East London Mosque. What we're currently looking at is the great Philgate Street Synagogue. And so it's kind of a fitting location to start this charity walk that you're kind of both embarking on.
My name's Ed Kessler. I'm the founder of the Wolf Institute in Cambridge, which looks at relations between Jews, Christians and Muslims.
This last year has been a difficult year for both communities. Both the communities will have felt the tension, will have been very closely aware of what's happening over in the Middle East, in Israel and in Gaza. Why now, and why this walk now?
Yes, it's been the most difficult year I've ever experienced since October the 7th and the war in Gaza. It's absolutely catastrophic. Now, the question is, are we paralysed by it, or we do something about it? And this is a tiny, symbolic gesture that Ibrahim and I are doing, a Muslim and a Jewish leader coming together, not just to raise funds for a Christian charity that does incredibly important work under awfully difficult conditions, but to model the coming together. Ibrahim and I don't agree on everything. In fact, we disagree on a lot, but we're friends. And I think you can still be friends whilst you disagree with one another.
For many within some of the communities, there doesn't seem to be a middle ground, a solvable issue here. I mean, can it really be a happy environment right now for people kind of trying to solve
this? We have no choice but to work together. If we go down the other route of polarisation, of violence, we will hang one by one. We have to hang together.
We're walking through the east end of London, into the city of London now, towards Bevis Mark Synagogue, and with Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra. Ibrahim, how difficult has the last year been for relationships between the two communities?
All of us who have held or put ourselves forward as faith leaders of our respective communities are facing pressure from within and from outside. where there are Muslim communities who feel that all interfaith work should be suspended and we should not engage at all. And then there is this silence or the absence of a voice that is calling just for the basic, you know, a ceasefire, please stop the bombing, stop the killing, and give peace a chance. People don't hear that voice enough.
How do you break that reticence? How do you encourage the communities to be able to talk when the disagreements are so stark?
Some faith leaders have decided not to engage, despite years of friendship, despite years of collaboration and working together. They refuse to do so anymore because of what's going on in Israel and Palestine. But we've got to keep going. The alternative is far worse. And I'd rather keep those friendships, keep those bridges intact.
Adrian.
Hi.
Rabbi Morris.
Hi.
It's just so symbolic for this group of Jews, Christians and Muslims to come to you now. Oldest synagogue in this country with its incredible history, but doing it collaboratively for humanitarian causes. So we're just pleased to be here, Rabbi.
Fantastic. Well, we're really pleased to be able to have you here with us at what is very much, still a building site, very much a historic location.
My name is Paul Hackwood. I'm an Anglican priest and a trustee of the St. John's Hospital.
Both Ed and Ibrahim talked about how this last year has perhaps been the most difficult it's been that they can remember. And you're talking about trying to show that communities can come together. Is that, for a lot of the communities, it can feel almost existential at the moment. How realistic do you think it is that communities can come back together?
Well, I think there's this idea, isn't there, that trust is a thing that simply appears. I mean, in all of the conflict situations across the world where there has been resolution, it started with small acts of witness to say, we want to live together peacefully. And that really, it's very, very difficult to see when you're in it, of course. And it's very frightening for Jews, and it's very frightening for Muslims, and for Christians indeed. It's not until we start to work together and we start to rebuild trust and get these relationships right that we start to see the change that will bring about a lasting resolution to the issues.
Good. Hi.
Can I just give you a round of applause?
All of us. Thank you so much.
A report from Adrian Bradley. Our final item runs against the current of change. While the census reports a shrinking body of Christian believers and the number who make it to the parish pews on Sundays heads steadily downwards, attendance at weekly services in cathedrals was up by 5% in 2023, and those great ships of heaven attracted over 9 million visitors last year. Those figures are in a Church of England report published this week, which also noted the exhibitions and events cathedrals have put on, not all of them strictly religious. Rochester Cathedral, for example, ran a mini golf course up the nave. Philip Hesketh is the dean.
It was just totally generational. There was young and old, and there was people of all genders and backgrounds and class groupings. It was just fantastic. And we stopped every day for prayer. People stood still. They then joined in when we invited them with the Lord's Prayer. And the conversations which flowed out of that were just amazing. And some people said to us, you know, we've lived here all our lives. We didn't know we could come in here. We didn't know it was for us. And we found particularly that year, a 60% increase in the numbers of people attending our Christmas services. And some of those certainly were people who said, we came for the golf and we thought we'd come and see the I think carol services are less threatening for people. But so we saw a massive increase. We were completely full. And many of them was because they'd been into the cathedral for the first time. The gospel is good news. That's what it means. It's good news. And what could not be good news about people of all ages and diversities coming together in the Lord's house, stopping for prayer, building community? What's not good news about that? It's okay, they're coming to play golf, but these things lead to other things, don't they? It seemed to me that's what the building's for. not to be empty, which is what some people think, that it should just be an empty space.
Well, not everyone has given the new experiment such glowing reviews. Tim Diep is the head of public policy at Christian Concern.
I don't really think it's appropriate for a cathedral that's built as a place of worship dedicated to God and consecrated for worship to have entertainment things like crazy golf, helter-skelters. And I think that people see this as kind of like an act of desperation to get people into cathedrals, you know, the sense of, you know, the church losing its way and not really having confidence in the gospel, not really having confidence in its own Christian message. And I think that's a very sorry state for the Church of England to be in. And I think it makes a mockery of these cathedrals. When I go to church, I go to worship God. I don't go to be entertained. There can be laughter and joy and all of these kind of things in a church service, but I'm not going for like simple entertainment. I'm going to worship God. The canon law says that churches should not be profaned by any meeting therein for temporal objects inconsistent with the sanctity of the place. And I think some of these would be in breach of canon law, I think. So, I mean, I'm pleased to see that numbers are increasing and I hope the gospel is being preached in those services. But I really question whether actually having these sort of entertainment gimmicks is a factor contributing towards that.
We're joined now by Simon Jenkins, who's a former newspaper editor and chair of the National Trust. He's written extensively about churches and cathedrals. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we talk first about the contrast between churches and cathedrals, with one going down in terms of numbers and the other going up? What's behind that?
I think a lot is behind it. It's a very interesting question. Parish churches, tragically, are in a real crisis now. I mean, about 5% of people go to church ever. More people go to a mosque than go to their parish church. They really do need to look at this very seriously, what the role they should be playing in the local community when they're physically so prominent in it. I think churches have got a big problem. The cathedrals are a totally different story. And whereas church attendance has gone down by 20-30% in this century, cathedral attendance is still up. It's actually going up. It's been badly hit by the pandemic, and a lot of the figures you just announced is to do with the pandemic rather than to cathedrals as such. But the cathedral story has been a very good news story since the beginning of the century, and I'm afraid I don't believe it's because of faith. The figures just don't justify that. It is because cathedrals have, in some sense, redefined themselves as major civic institutions. And it is precisely because they do things that aren't necessarily connected with the Christian faith that this has happened. It's not tourism. It's people actually going to services, to enjoying festivals, to enjoying concerts, to enjoying plays and so on in cathedrals. They seem to love these places. And I think we need to distinguish what it is people want from a church rather than what's happening there.
You say redefine themselves, but it's probably true historically, isn't it, that cathedrals have been or have had a civic role since their earliest days. St. Paul's, for example, was the great book-selling centre of London.
St. Paul's was Publisher's Alley. You're quite right. I think what they're doing is they're rediscovering what you just described. It's extremely interesting, I think. There's a famous essay by Grace Davey, a sociologist, some time ago, about why it is that more people are going to cathedrals than before. And I believe it has very little to do with Christianity. I'm sorry to say this to friends of mine in the church. But it has to do with the fact that a cathedral is a special sort of place. It's a place of contemplation, of meditation. You can go there on your own and not feel lonely. It's very curiously restorative. And I think an awful lot of people go to what's sometimes been called vicarious worship. It's not to do with the Christian faith. It's to do with one's desire for some spiritual experience in a very beautiful place. Music has a lot to do with that. Architecture has a lot to do with it. Well, but it's one of the reasons why they're doing so well.
Let's talk a little bit about some of these experiments. I mean, we heard from the Dean of Rochester there, a diocese founded by one of St. Augustine's companions in, I think, the 6th century. The building was begun in the 11th century. Two martyrs were bishops, one Anglican and one Catholic during the Reformation. Huge amount of history. Mini golf, really?
Well, I mean, don't necessarily distinguish those things you just mentioned. It's a wonderful cathedral, Rochester. And I just think that the way in which a cathedral chooses to make itself a service to the community is not that important. I mean, golf is not a sinful activity.
Some might dispute that, but that's another matter.
I thought the Helter Skelter in Norfolk, in Norwich, was sensational. It's a wonderful structure. Music has been in cathedrals since the earliest times. Music is not necessarily religious. Is often secular, as are plays, as are all the things that take place. I mean, services, meetings for local universities. I mean, the fact that the cathedral has a purpose in its community, wider than that of worship, is a good thing, not a bad thing. And I think they should do far, far more of it.
Raise the question, and we've only got a little time to answer it in, but can they survive forever as faith diminishes, simply as civic centres, if that's the trajectory we're heading on?
I put it wider than that. They have got to. They have said, the churches and cathedrals are listed buildings, so to speak. They are there forever. I hope there's nowhere they're ever demolished, but they've got to redefine their purpose in an important respect, that they reach out to people in the community other than just Christians wanting somewhere to worship. And this concept of wellness, this concept of a placid, helpful, restorative place to go and sit and be quiet is very, very important.
We will leave it there. Simon James, thanks so much for talking to us this morning. Sunday Worship After the News is about the religious life. That's in the sense of monks and nuns rather than more generally. And the Dominican friar, Father Timothy Radcliffe, will be the preacher. That's all from us. You can, of course, listen again or download the programme as a podcast from the BBC Sounds app. I'll be back next week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Sunday was produced by Baratu Ibrahim and Katie Davis. The studio producers were Kelly Young and John Benton. Now, the Ambassador of Lepra, Victoria Hislop, presents this week's Radio 4 Appeal.
Over the past 7 years, Radio 4 listeners have achieved something incredible. You've helped transform the lives of more than 1.5 million people in Bangladesh and India by providing screening and life-changing care for leprosy, for which we are truly grateful. In 2017, I spoke to you about how early detection and treatment of leprosy is reducing the transmission of the disease, but more needs to be done when it comes to the stigma affecting millions of people dealing with its lifelong impact. Take Maksuda, a young mother from a village near Sirajganj in Bangladesh. When Maksuda noticed white patches on her hands and lost her sense of touch, she suspected the worst and was fearful for her future. You see, many people in remote communities often don't know they have leprosy and have no way of getting treated until it's too late. Thankfully, Maksuda was diagnosed at a lepra outreach screening and immediately started a course of medication. Although successfully cured, Maksuda still faced emotional abuse from her husband, who imprisoned her at home away from her family and friends because he believed she was cursed. He also kept her away from their food for fear of her contaminating it, and filed for divorce and even stopped her from seeing their one-year-old daughter Neela. Maksuda was then thrown out of her home and, in her own words, was an outcast. No one would speak to her. That's when Lepra stepped in again, and with their help, Maksuda and Neela were able to access safe accommodation, professional counselling and a sewing machine, so Maksuda could set up a small tailoring business. In time, she saved up enough money to start a poultry farm with 300 chicks. As her business grew, so too did her confidence. In fact, with the help of Lepra, Maksuda started a community support group, which is part of a network of more than 900 across the country, helping other women who've been diagnosed with leprosy. A gift of £24 can train a volunteer to detect leprosy within the community and enable thousands of women just like Maksuda to face their diagnosis with confidence and dignity. Today, Maksuda is happy and healthy, and Neela is studying physiotherapy so she too can help the most vulnerable. To give now, search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144, or you can write a cheque to Lepra and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. please mark the back of your envelope Lepra. Thank you.
Victoria Hislop. That number is 0800 404 8144. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles. Let's check the weather now with Sarah Keith-Lucas. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there, Andrew. Well, we're looking at a fairly unsettled picture today, particularly across England and Wales. Some heavy downpours on offer. Scotland and Northern Ireland, mostly dry, but not as warm as it's been over recent days. So we'll start with southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, because we've had some heavy showers that have moved across the region overnight. They've eased for a time, but what we're going to see for the rest of the day really is some sunny, dry intervals, but also showers cropping up at times. If you do catch them, they're going to be heavy, potentially thundery, could be some hail and some localised flooding. But as is the nature with these showers, they'll come and go. So some spells of blue sky in between. Top temperatures around about 20 to 23 degrees. And then further north and west, so a zone through southwest England into Wales and across all of northern England, we'll be stuck under a slow-moving weather front today. So a cloudy day without breaks of rain, quite a lot of drizzle and fog is around this morning as well. So a murky start, and that rain will be on and off through the day. So not too persistent for the Great North Run, for instance, but certainly patchy rain coming and going. Highs here, 19 or 20 degrees. Scotland and Northern Ireland, more cloud than we've had over recent days. Low cloud in places, some fog, some drizzle around too. That'll linger across northern and eastern areas, but it will brighten up in the west, particularly western Scotland, where we could see highs of 23 degrees, but most places around 18 to 21. Northern Ireland should stay dry all day, but there'll be some rain into the east of Scotland into the evening hours. Now, overnight tonight, cloud and rain slowly ease away towards the east, lingering longest around eastern coast, with clearer skies moving in behind. So a fresher night than we've had of late, with temperatures down into mid-single figures for some parts of Scotland and Northern Ireland. Tomorrow, rain slowly clearing away from the east, brighter skies in the west, and then it turns more autumnal, cooler and breezier for all of us through the week ahead.
Thanks, Sarah. At 10 o'clock, we're at the Brandenburg Gate to relive the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 in the reunion. Before that, at 9, as my teenagers say, how'd you like them apples? It's Broadcasting House with Paddy O'Connell. Morning, Paddy.
Yes, good morning, Andrew, and hello, good morning to you. Well, we are actually talking about apples, which I feel I can reveal to you as a peach, believe
me. All fruit are welcome.
All fruit are welcome. Well, Raymond Blanc, the Michelin chef, has praised British apples as the best in the world. He's our guest today, but we wondered, can you find them on the shelves? It's peak harvest now, and some listeners say there's just a bunch of old foreign crunchers on the shelves. Three listeners who gave up their smartphone for a dumb one rate the impact on their life. And Stonehenge, we're told, is overrated. But we'll begin with an interview with the Secretary of State for Health.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 8th of September. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Sir Keir Starmer has told the BBC he's prepared to be unpopular to deliver the change he believes the country needs. An official report on NHS England will highlight long waiting lists for children needing hospital treatment. And after 11 days of competition, the Paralympics will end this evening with a grand closing ceremony in Paris. The Prime Minister has told the BBC that his new government is going to have to be unpopular if it wants to change the country. Speaking to Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, and in his first major interview in Number 10, Sir Keir Starmer said it was vital to do difficult things now, such as the cuts to pensioners' winter fuel payments, and not to run away from hard choices, which he accused previous governments of doing. He was speaking to Laura Koonsberg.
Politicians normally try to grow their popularity, but barely 2 months into office, the Prime Minister says his government is going to have to lose favour with the public. Defending his decision to strip most pensioners of the winter fuel allowance, he told me he was resolved to take difficult decisions early in office to sort out the country's problems.
We will only deliver that change, I'm absolutely determined we will, if we do the difficult things now. I know they're unpopular. I know they're difficult. Of course they're tough choices.
A note there, you said you know it's unpopular. Are you willing to be unpopular?
We're going to have to be unpopular. Popular decisions aren't tough. They're easy. When we talk about tough decisions, I'm talking about tough decisions. The things that last government ran away from, that governments traditionally run away from, I'm convinced that because they've run away from difficult decisions, we haven't got the change we need for the country.
Sir Keir will be tested in Parliament on that resolve this week, when MPs vote on the winter fuel decision. With his massive Commons majority, the vote is unlikely to make much of a dent in his authority, if at all. And you
can see the full interview on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg on BBC One at 9 o'clock this morning. The first details to emerge from a report on the state of the NHS in England, due later this week, have highlighted severe problems for children and young people getting access to care. The review, carried out by the surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi, also says the health service was particularly hard hit during the pandemic. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The medical expert Lord Darzi was asked to carry out a rapid review of the state of the health service in England. His report highlights waiting lists for children and young people, with 175,000 waiting between 6 and 12 months for hospital treatment. He also says that there was relatively a much bigger reduction in routine NHS operations during the pandemic than in other health systems. Sir Keir Starmer said he was determined to fix the foundations and rebuild the health service. But health leaders are warning that the government's plan to ensure that most NHS patients in England start treatment within 18 weeks isn't realistic. Ministers have promised to deliver 40,000 more operations and appointments each week. The NHS Confederation, which represents employers, says that will deliver only about 15% of the extra capacity needed to hit the target.
The first TUC conference under a Labour government for more than a decade begins in Brighton later. Trade unions are expected to vote to campaign for above-inflation pay rises in the public sector. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken will travel to London tomorrow to meet the Foreign Secretary David Lammy and senior officials. Washington says the two-day visit will reaffirm the special relationship between the countries. Here's our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman.
The US says Antony Blinken will discuss a range of critical issues while in London, including the Middle East and what it calls collective efforts to support Ukraine. The meetings come as Kyiv makes another plea for permission to fire missiles much deeper into Russia, something the White House has long refused. It's understood Mr. Blinken is also likely to meet Sir Keir Starmer during the trip before the Prime Minister travels to Washington for his second one-on-one meeting with President Biden at the White House. This is in part about Washington wanting to cement a solid relationship with a new government in the UK. But there are differences, including the Labour government's decision to drop its predecessor's plan to challenge the right of the International Criminal Court to seek an arrest warrant for Israeli leaders over the war in Gaza.
Security forces in Venezuela have surrounded the Argentine embassy in the capital Caracas, where six political opponents of President Maduro are sheltering. The foreign ministry alleged that terrorist acts are being plotted inside. Venezuela's government says Edmundo González, who stood against Mr. Maduro in elections in July, has left the country after seeking asylum in Spain. Hundreds of thousands of people have joined protests across Israel to demand a ceasefire deal from their government, allowing hostages to be released in Gaza. The rallies marked 11 months to the day since 250 people were abducted by Hamas. From Jerusalem, Mike Thompson reports.
This seventh consecutive night of protests was one of the biggest so far. The Hostage Families Forum, which organized the rallies, estimated that more than 500,000 people took part in Tel Aviv and said a further 250,000 demonstrated elsewhere. Placard-waving protesters insisting their government isn't doing enough to secure a ceasefire deal blocked roads and police made several arrests. Overnight, sirens blared in northern Israel as Lebanon's Hezbollah movement fired around 50 projectiles into the region. Most were shot down and no injuries were reported. The cross-border attacks came as Israel launched airstrikes in southern Lebanon.
The king is marking 2 years since the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth, and his accession to the throne. A special edition of Songs of Praise on BBC One this afternoon will feature a new hymn commissioned by the king. The Paralympics will end in Paris this evening with a three-hour closing ceremony at the Stade de France. Great Britain have won 120 medals, including 47 golds, and will be hoping to add to that tally before the end of the day. Our disability correspondent Nikki Fox reports.
After 11 days, 549 events and numerous world records broken, the Paralympics will come to an end with a grand closing ceremony. Paralympics GB have surpassed the number of golds achieved at the Tokyo Games and reached their medal target of more than 100 set by UK Sport. But this was about more than just the sport. The International Paralympic Committee has said it wanted these to be the best games ever, and they believe they've delivered. However, for some disabled fans, there have been issues around access to venues and isolated transport problems. The hope is the Paralympics will lead to a lasting change in Paris, including investment in the city's ageing metro to improve the lives of disabled residents.
Well, that's the news this morning. Now a look at the Sunday papers. And the Sunday Times reports that Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital is conducting an urgent review into the cases of 721 children who were treated by the same surgeon. It says some of Yasser Jabbar's patients were left with life-changing injuries, such as amputations and deformities. The Times has seen a leaked report by the Royal College of Surgeons, which criticises the department where Mr. Jabbar worked as dysfunctional. The consultant, who now works in Dubai, has declined to comment. Great Ormond Street has apologised and promised to address the findings of the review. The Observer says Lord Darzi's report on the state of the NHS in England will be particularly critical of reforms carried out by David Cameron's coalition government. It will apparently describe the reorganisation designed by the Conservative former Health Secretary Andrew Lansley as a calamity without international precedent. Lord Lansley tells the paper that Lord Darzi should focus on the here and now rather than trying to blame the Tories. The Sunday Express says Sir Keir Starmer faces a revolt by Labour MPs angry about his decision to cut winter fuel payments. The paper quotes the Labour MP Rosie Duffield, who told the Today programme the decision was brutal and shameful. The Express says Sir Keir is working to keep a lid on party infighting. The Mail on Sunday says tax rises being prepared by Labour are putting Britain on a path to destitution. Its report focuses on statistics put together by a firm which helps wealthy people to move overseas. The data suggests a record number of the UK's highest earners are planning to leave the country because they expect to be targeted in next month's budget. The Sunday Telegraph's main story suggests the BBC has breached its own editorial guidelines 1,500 times in its coverage of the war in Gaza. It says a report which used artificial intelligence to analyse BBC News output revealed a pattern of bias against Israel. The research was led by a British lawyer based in Jerusalem, Trevor Assassin. In response, the BBC questions the use of AI in the study and insists that the corporation is achieving due impartiality. Under the headline Half the World Away, the Sunday Mirror reports that Oasis are planning to take next year's reunion tour overseas. It says the band are in talks about playing in the US, Mexico and Argentina. The paper says international dates could take their profits to more than £500 million. And the Telegraph's sports section says England's footballers hit the right notes in their 2-0 win against the Republic of Ireland last night. That's a nod to their new coach, Lee Carsley, not singing the national anthem before kick-off. Yesterday's edition of the paper took a dim view of that decision, while the Mail wanted him sacked forthwith. This morning, though, it reports that the FA are standing by their man after what it calls a dream start.
This is BBC Radio 4. It's 8:10, time for Sunday Worship, which this week explores the ancient calling of religious life.
Good morning and welcome to Sunday Worship. I'm the Reverend Richard Carter from St Martin in the Fields and leader of the Nazareth community. This week we explore the ancient calling of religious life. Ever since those first disciples heard Jesus' call to leave everything behind and follow him, both men and women have experienced that deep inner and often radical calling to leave family and home and their former ambitions and devote themselves to following the path of Jesus Christ in community. The monastic promises or vows a brother or sister takes often seem so countercultural, so diametrically opposed to the values of our world. These may include poverty, chastity, obedience, the dedication to prayer and silence, the focus on charity, hospitality and care for the poor. And these demands do not fit easily with modern Western lifestyles, where often the predominant message is that success depends upon possession and ownership, wealth and choice and power. And yet, have we not all, struggling under the weight of the contradictions and stresses of our own lives, at moments glimpsed a calling to a greater freedom, a generosity and fullness of life? The sense deep within that a better way of living and a humbler, more perfect way of loving is possible. Remember Jesus' words to the rich young man who came to him saying, "I have kept all the commandments, what do I still lack?" And Jesus replies, "If you wish to be perfect, go, sell your possessions and give your money to the poor, and you will have treasures in heaven. Then come and follow me." So what is it, I wonder, in your life that you really seek? It is a great question. Saint Augustine responded after many years to that question with this profound realization: "Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." Let us pray. Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, that what I do in anything, to do it as for thee. Timothy Radcliffe is a Dominican friar, a worldwide order called the Order of Preachers. He is based at Blackfriars in Oxford, and I asked him about his life.
Every one of us begins the day in silence. It might be just 20 minutes or half an hour, where you just go and you are in the presence of the Lord. And because initially your mind is filled with all sorts of other thoughts. What am I going to have for breakfast? And why on earth did somebody say this to me yesterday? But slowly, slowly, you sink into a silence in which you can say to the Lord, "Here I am, Lord." And I think if you listen to the Lord, you learn to listen to each other without being defensive. So much of our listening in our society is defensive. Marilynne Robinson, that marvelous American novelist who wrote great things like Gilead, she said, "Nothing can be said about God from a posture of defense." I think in the silence of prayer, we become vulnerable. We lower the defenses. We take off the armor so that we can say to God, "Here I am," and to each other too.
Oh, A reading from the Acts of the Apostles. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. Awe came upon everyone, because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having the goodwill of all the people.
I'm Sister Grace, a member of the Order of the Holy Paraclete. I've been a member since 1962. I think religious life is a symbol of total commitment to God. It's a searching and it's a being sought. I'm still learning a lot of things about myself, about other people, about God, about what it means to be human, recognizing that we are all loved uniquely by God.
I'm Helen. I live in the Order of the Holy Paraclete in Whitby in North Yorkshire. We're a community of women. And living with any group is not always easy. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. And the good things are the sisters and the bad things are the sisters. And the reason you stay is the sisters, because they become part of you and you become part of them. There's a huge amount of love here. It doesn't always manifest itself in very lovey-dovey ways, but it manifests itself in the small things and the way we look after each other and support each other. And sometimes it's the very practical things, like, I'll do that, you push off. And, you know, it's that sort of thing that you do for each other and look out for each other.
Well, I've had my rocky times and I've often wondered whether I'd done the right thing. I know I've done the right thing. God has affirmed this many, many times. And it's wonderful to have this affirmation through people, through the people you least expect. Like one of the gardeners said to me, how long have you been in this place? And I tried to tell them. He said, oh my goodness me. He said, I haven't lived as long as that.
The Sisters of the Holy Paraclete also have two households in Ghana. One of their sisters from Ghana, Sister Abba, spoke about her foundational role in reaching out to those who are blind and establishing an eye hospital, which has helped with the restoration and improvement of the sight for many and care and support for many more.
I see roughly about 200 patients a day at the eye clinic. Roughly about 50 people will call in without any appointment. They just come and they want to see sister. Sometimes what they really want to see me about is to discuss about their eye ailment, the challenges they are going through with their family, or rather something personal that they know when they share with me, It wouldn't go outside the convent walls. Gracious God, we thank you that you are the creator of all. Above all, you are the creator of each person who has ever lived, who lives now, and who will be alive in the future. In your own way, transform us so that we may live in love, in peace, in joy, in life that is everlasting. We bless you, Father, for this wonderful gift of life. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Truly I tell you, that just as you did it for one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it for me.
I'm Sister Maria. I belong to the Daughters of Charity, which is an organisation, Catholic organisation, that works throughout the world serving people that suffer from the effects of poverty. St. Vincent and St. Louise were the founders of the Daughters of Charity. Vincent de Paul seemed to have a kind of light bulb year in his life in 1617 when he discovered for himself the tragedy of people dying when they have no idea of God's love for them, and people that were dying also because they were starving and they couldn't get food, they couldn't eat, there was nobody caring for them. For Vincent, the poor person was God. Vincent saw God in every poor person, and in the way that you would serve a rich person. He also taught the early sisters that when they were praying in the chapel and the doorbell went, they should leave God in the chapel to meet God at the door and to pay attention to that person and do the best for them, because that was Jesus there standing at the door. When you work with people and when you see how they struggle, It draws something out of us that I often think that, you know, if we had a world where everybody was perfect, would we really have that love and that goodness? Because sometimes it's when people have got big problems in life that it draws love out of other people. So I think sometimes we need something to draw love out of us. Prayer is important to me because I don't really think that we can be our best person without sitting in the presence of God and just allowing God to work through us. And it's hard because we clutter ourselves up with our ego and all of that. Prayer is like the opportunity to empty ourselves and to be filled with the Spirit of God that will work through us and reach out to other people. So in some sense, when we talked about Vincent praying in the chapel and you leave God in the chapel to go to God at the door, then the God in me from my prayer in the chapel that will meet the God at the door.
Rejoice and be glad, for the Lord is great in heaven.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy.
Religious community life is not just something of the past. Much of the wisdom and spiritual depth of the monastic way of life and the importance of contemplative prayer is so much needed in our church today, and it is being rediscovered and can revitalize our faith. The Nazareth community is one such community which began in 2018. It is a gathered community which meets at St. Martin in the Fields but also online, keeping a simple contemporary rule of life based on seven S's: silence, service, scripture, sacrament, sharing, Sabbath time, and staying with. We try to live simply, generously, and prayerfully, and it is a community that is enriched by those who come from different parts of the world, some of whom are migrants and refugees and have become part of our community.
My name name is Len Walker. I'm a part of the Nazareth community. I have been so from the very beginning and hope to continue endlessly. I have faced more dangers and perils than one could imagine, but my strength comes from my involvement with the church, St. Martin's in the Field, as well as my intimate involvement with the Nazareth community. It is the source that I draw upon in the midst of all the problems that I have, and that's where my solution comes from. My life has been threatened on so many occasions, both here in England and elsewhere, and it is always in these moments of crisis that I've called upon my God, and He has provided me with the solution that I need. I have been homeless here in London for quite a number of years. I have gone through quite a bit of travail with COVID and other things, but with the blessing and guidance of the Nazareth community and its leadership, I have been able to survive.
I'm Fiona Macmillan. I'm a member of the Nazareth community at St. Martin in the Fields. For me, the Nazareth community provides a framework for my life. It roots me in silence, which I've discovered is a wellspring of life. It's a place I can go back to again and again, to, no matter how empty I feel, to find myself, to be refound, to be replenished and filled. The Nazareth community is a place where we are following a path, and although we're all very different from one another, somehow in coming together, we are like pieces of a jigsaw. What we see is not our diversity, but we see our strength in our differences, and we celebrate and value one another exactly as we are. And there are so few places in life where you can feel celebrated and accepted and have your needs understood or heard and your gifts encouraged.
My name is Simon Sang. I wanted to join the Nazareth community because I find my life just very busy, and I wanted somewhere I could find a space of just stillness and silence and inviting God into my life. Contemplative prayer has really helped me to listen well to God. It's helped me to take away all my thoughts and anxieties and all the things that are causing me so much sadness in life, and actually listen to what God is saying, and reminded that God loves me, and inviting God to bring that joy and peace into my life. It's just been a wonderful experience of being able to love those from different parts of the world, of being able to sit and eat with those who the world sees that they have no status and they have no possessions, but we see each other as equal.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends, if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide. So that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. This I command you, to love one another.
The call to the religious life is at its heart a call to love one another as Christ has loved us. It's a call to live with the humility of the Beatitudes and a courage that comes from God alone. Our preacher for today is Father Timothy Radcliffe, who began by speaking about the freedom that the love of Christ brings. For Timothy, the call into friendship is at the heart of the gospel. It is when the me becomes us.
Our way of life as religious seems crazy to most people. We take vows of poverty, which means we do not own anything individually, chastity, which means giving up sex, and obedience, which sounds like giving up freedom. A recipe for an infantile existence, it seems. It was my great-uncle Dick who showed me that this is not true. He was a monk who was a chaplain in the First World War. He was extraordinarily brave. He went every night into no man's land to look for the wounded. He lost an eye and most of his fingers to a hand grenade. But he was the most joyful and alive person I ever met. He showed that religious life is a way of being wonderfully alive. Jesus said, "I've come that they may have life and have it abundantly." How is this possible? Jesus said in the gospel we've just heard, "I call you friends." He offered friendship to everyone, from sex workers to his enemies. The Christian life is friendship with God and each other. And the vows of religious life form us for this spacious friendship. There are, of course, other ways of life which are equally good. Chastity is the most difficult to understand, and it can take a long time to discover its joy. It's a way of loving, or it's nothing. God's love is particular for each of us, and it's universal for everyone. When you give yourself to another in a unique relationship, such as marriage, you're a sign of God's particular love. You say to someone, "It's marvelous you exist." But you cannot remain stuck eyeball to eyeball. You need to open your love to others, children, friends, anyone who needs it. The vow of chastity is a sign of God's universal love. You promise friendship to whoever turns up at the door, whoever crosses your path, or at least you try. Chastity forms you for God's wide friendship. Of course, you must also be open to love particular people. But the soil in which you're planted is God's wide-open friendship. Obedience sounds pretty infantile, like a flight from responsibility, doing what you're told without question. But the word obedience comes from the Latin ob audiens, meaning to listen deeply. You vow to listen to the community of your brothers and sisters. We take decisions together. This is of the essence of friendship. We attend to each other with all our intelligence and imagination. Today, most politics is about shouting slogans. As a society, we need to learn to listen deeply to those with whom we disagree. And poverty. Well, most religious are not really poor. We have comfortable lives. But our lives should be simple, and we share everything. We have a common life. It's a glorious protest against the silliness of thinking that people are important because of their possessions and status in our profoundly unequal society. Becoming a religious, I entered a world that was entirely free of class. We're all just brothers and sisters called to friendship. Religious life is not better than other ways of life, but as my great uncle showed me, it should be filled with the joy of friendship with God and others.
What is it that we seek? We are beheld and we behold. We are accepted and we accept. We are gathered and we gather. We are inspired and we inspire. We are enriched and we enrich. We are restored and we restore. We are given life. We live life in all its fullness. We are loved. We love.
God, teach us to love you. Teach us to serve you. Teach us to give our best in every circumstances we are in. And above all, direct our ways at all times. Amen.
Heavenly Father, give me the joy of being with others, and give me hope always that whatever occurs in my journey, I'm on my way to the kingdom where humanity will find the joy and the fulfillment for which we all long. We ask you this through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory, for ever and ever. Amen. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up the light of his countenance upon you and give you his peace. My sisters, my brothers, may the Lord bless you now and forever. Amen.
Sunday worship was led by the Reverend Richard Carter of the Nazareth Community in London. The preacher was Dominican Friar Father Timothy Radcliffe. The producer was Andrew Earis. And next week, Sunday worship marks the season of harvest with music by the composer Bob Chilcott and reflections from One Church, Brighton. Now on Radio 4, a point of view, a personal essay from a leading writer. Here's Sarah Dunant.
At 2 a.m. UK time next Wednesday morning, I'll be mainlining coffee and propping open my eyelids in front of a computer screen. Because in the city of Philadelphia, 9 p.m. Tuesday night their time, an encounter will be taking place which could go a long way to deciding America's future. The first, and as yet only confirmed, presidential debate between the Republican candidate Donald Trump and the new Democratic candidate Kamala Harris. Such television debates have been drawing audiences for over half a century now, but the anticipation surrounding this one is palpable. Partly, of course, thanks to the cracking of the political tectonic plates with Joe Biden's abject performance in the last TV debate against Trump, which led to his resignation and the anointing of Kamala Harris, the first black and Asian female ever to be a candidate for highest office. But that's not the reason I'll be staying up late. No, this is more personal. I want to see what happens when, 8 years on, Donald Trump finds himself again debating a woman. I know I'm not the only one of my sex to have razor-sharp memories of a certain encounter with Hillary Clinton. How, in front of a small studio audience on an even smaller stage, Trump prowled around her, at key moments coming up directly behind her as she was speaking, his bulk and scowling face caught firmly on camera. For those watching, and clearly for Clinton herself, it felt deeply uncomfortable. Not least because it came only a few days after the release of a video where Trump bragged about his power to grope and intimidate women. The media response to the debate was damning. Looming, threatening, even the word stalking was used. As one female commentator, an ex-Republican strategist, put it, "If a man did that to me on the street, I'd call 911. One of his most staunch supporters was forced into inverted anthropomorphic language in his defence. "He was like a big silverback gorilla," said one Nigel Farage. "He dominated, took control. What you saw was the way he is. That much, at least, we can all agree with." Suffice it to say that when that silverback and Harris meet next Tuesday, I doubt anyone will stray from the podium. But the change is not just stage dressing, because in the 8 years since that encounter, the history of sexual politics and the position of women in America has been through seismic change, for better and for worse. While it is true that a good number of women in 2016 chose not to vote for Hillary, Trump's victory galvanized hundreds of thousands more into immediate action. The day after his inauguration, Washington and other parts of the country saw what was then the largest single-day protest in U.S. history under the banner of the Women's March, forefronting issues of sexual violence, race discrimination, and the threat to reproductive rights. By the end of the year, the issue of sexual abuse and the need to hold even the most powerful men to account for it had exploded into public consciousness with the rebirth of the Me Too movement. The tsunami of public accusations against movie mogul Harvey Weinstein would go on to topple close to 200 prominent men, celebrities, heads of TV networks, figures in business and politics. It was a seminal moment in the history of feminism. Would it have happened if Clinton had won? What ifs are dangerous business in history, but for my money, I think it was precisely that spontaneous eruption of anger at Trump's victory which galvanized women, many of them younger, to find their voice. It also empowered older ones, not least the journalist E. Jean Carroll, who pursued and won a civil case for sexual abuse and defamation against Donald Trump, which came to court after his presidency, and was awarded huge damages. But it wasn't all good news for the rights of women. And here I need to get personal again. In the early 1970s, I was a young woman travelling in America when, with the Supreme Court judgment of Roe v. Wade, abortion became legal. In that moment, following close on the legalisation of contraception for all, history was made, guaranteeing millions of women like me a future profoundly different to that of our mothers and grandmothers. All that changed when Donald Trump, who once described himself as very pro-choice, delivered what he had promised, appointing three conservative Supreme Court judges to shift the balance of the court. 2 years after Trump lost the election to Biden, those appointments bore fruit when in June 2022, the court overturned Roe v. Wade. At a stroke, America, once in the vanguard of reproductive rights for women, felt more like a dystopian Margaret Atwood novel. If younger women had been the driving force behind the Me Too movement, this attack on reproductive rights created a cross-generational howl of fury. It also carried political heft. Over the years, polls have consistently shown a majority of Americans to be in favor of a woman's right to choose. In a number of states where punitive anti-abortion laws were passed, they have now been overturned successfully. Such angry voter energy was seen as one of the key reasons Republicans did so badly in the last midterms. And Trump himself, meanwhile, has been busy backpedaling, promising that he will never sign a federal law outlawing abortion. But with his religious base agitating not only on abortion, but also the questions of IVF, the stakes could not be higher. For the Democrats, it should have been a clear vote winner. The problem was not the message, but the messenger. One of the most painful moments when those two old gladiators met for their return slugging match in June was watching how badly Biden dropped the ball on the issue of abortion. Enter a different messenger. Not only is Kamala Harris the right gender for this fight, she is younger, smarter, and faster on her feet. Stepping into the glare of the spotlight, she gives off the aura of a woman comfortable in her own skin. Honed in adversarial debate in the courtroom, she also manages to combine authority with warmth. A magic combination in a female politician, and one that for all of her competence, Hillary Clinton lacked. And she is in possession of a smile, so natural and so dazzling that it's a little like watching the sun break through a bank of grey cloud, which is by no means a trivial thing in this current politics of gloom. Of course, it's not that simple. There are a slew of other issues besides the rights of women. Cost of living, the border, tax, Israel, Gaza, and lower down the list, climate change. On the first two, Trump long ago cemented his core support, turning the grievances felt by many rural and working class Americans into a fireball of fear and fury. In contrast, Harris can plug into anger when she needs to. How dare they trample on a woman's right to choose? But she's careful how she plays it. In the same way she is not shouting her gender from the rooftops, she has widened the abortion fight to include that great American shibboleth, the freedom of the individual from state interference. And she fashions the message through optimism, the promise of future. The yes, we can that propelled Obama into the White House has already been reminted into the yes, we can. In barely 6 weeks, she's created a feedback loop of energy between her and her supporters, which is reminiscent of the adulatory relationship between Trump and his own followers. And I suspect it is this, as much as the size of her cheering crowds, that is throwing him off his stride when it comes to landing a punch. Name-calling and sexual slanders are not going to win him any undecided voters. It's worth remembering that American politics wasn't always like this. In the 8 years since Trump unleashed his screams of consciousness, insulting and demeaning any and all who oppose him, he has coarsened both the language and the culture, normalizing dangerous levels of aggression. For me, it's no coincidence that those same years have seen the rise of a new kind of toxic masculinity, the Andrew Tate brand of bragging misogyny. That early feminist slogan, "The personal is political," could not be more relevant now. I don't know if Kamala Harris has what it takes to be a great president, or even a really good one. Being able to hold a crowd is not the same thing as being able to govern a country. But I do know that given the choice, what the future of America, indeed not just America, needs now, is a smart, younger woman rather than a toxic old man who has done such damage to the lives of women, both politically and personally. Which is why I, for one, shall be glued to a screen next Wednesday morning, an encounter worth losing sleep for.
A Point of View was written and presented by Sarah Genant. The producer was Adele Armstrong. Paddy O'Connell standing by with Broadcasting House as we find out how BH listeners have been coping without their smartphones. First, tweet of the day, and the author James Henry enjoys little turns following him while windsurfing on the Blackwater estuary.
Windsurfing on the Essex Blackwater all year round, I get to see the coming and goings of the seasons through bird migration across the estuary. In the winter we have divers, and in the summer, terns. The terns I share the sea with are purposeful and direct in their flight, none of the aimless wheeling about of gulls for them. If the wind is in the right direction, terns will tolerate me sailing alongside them. Common terns, stoic and elegant, cruising at head height, or if I'm lucky, I'm joined by little terns, the UK's smallest tern. Despite the spray and sometimes dazzling sunlight, it's easy to tell little terns apart from their more graceful cousins. Little terns have a faster, almost frantic wing beat. You can sense the effort. Occasionally they will veer upwards and hover before diving for fish, whereas a common tern will, it seems, just casually dip in as if something catches their eye. The excitement of little terns is compounded because they are nesting close by on a remote shingle beach